Good evening and welcome to the Tuesday, January 15th, 2013. Holy smokes. Board of Aldermen meeting, regular business meeting. The first item on our agenda is the appointment of a new mayor pro tem. You'll notice that a number of items on our agenda relate directly or indirectly to the fact that Alderman Dan Coleman has moved to Australia. I have no doubt he'll be watching. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Dan. Hey, Dan.
All right. Is there... it's been traditional for us to...
I have a motion.
Okay. Let's hear it.
I'd like to move that we appoint Lydia Lavelle as our mayor pro tem.
Second.
I think she will be excellent and very good at planting trees if you can't make it.
It has been traditional for many years now in Carrboro for this responsibility to devolve onto the most senior member of the Board of Aldermen who has not already done, have not already served as our mayor pro tem. And we'll just pause briefly to recognize that Jackie Gist, who is our most senior by way of experience member of the Board of Aldermen, served maybe more than once, I don't know,
but
a number of years ago in the capacity. Mm-hmm. And it is Lydia's, our most senior member who has not previously served as mayor pro tem. Lydia, do you have any comments or anyone else?
Happy to serve.
All right. It has been moved and properly seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much. I probably should already have noted that we also have one excused absence as one of our board members is currently out of the country. All right. That brings us to requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. I believe we have a number of people signed up tonight to speak on various items that are before the Board of Aldermen that are already on our printed agenda. I have only one person who has signed up to speak on a matter that is perhaps not on our agenda. Jenny Schnack, could you join us? Come on up and stand right over here at the podium. If you come this side of the podium and walk around.
Okay. Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you.
Everyone, my name is Jenny Schnock. I'm here on behalf of a new venture that has just been organized. It's called the Carrboro Wild Food and Herb Market. Myself, Jenny Schnock, and Josh Lev are organizing this to begin this spring in Carrboro. It is essentially a market to celebrate the wild foods and herbs of the Carolina Piedmont. It's designed to bring people together around learning about the wild foods and herbs that grow in this area, and also a place to buy and sell them. So it serves as not only a platform for a marketplace, but a marketplace of learning, too. So when you're foraging or looking for wild foods, it's mostly based on plant identification. And so we find that this is a great platform for environmental education as well. Therein, about half of this market would be vendors, and then half of it would be educational organizations from around Chapel Hill, Pittsboro, Durham, and throughout. And so we find that this opportunity would really, this market would provide a lot of benefits for the town of Carrboro. It's namely one of the first of its kind in the country. There are no other wild food markets regularly occurring in the United States, and we'd like to hold it the first Sunday of each month from 1 to 4 p.m. at Carrboro Commons. And so in a way, it would really boost tourism. It could bring a lot of new people to Carrboro, and the involved stakeholders would be students, people into, you know, I guess, learning about botany and herbology, as well as chefs and foodies, and already build upon the high concentration of in this food shed of enthusiasm around food. It would also include a diverse range of participants. We'd hopefully have some of the Karen community from Carrboro, from the Transplanting Traditions Community Farm involved. They grow all sorts of kind of medicinal plants. We'd have farmers from around the region that usually have kind of culled out wild foods that aren't typically sold at farmers markets, like amaranth or lamb's quarters, things like that. And then all it kind of serve as a space to market for nature camps and after school programs having to do with I guess learning more about plant identification for children. So it could really be a wonderful community gathering space and a huge contribution to Carrboro. So what I'm proposing is we would love the support of the town of Carrboro. Since it's a startup venture, we would really like for the town to sponsor it and perhaps waive the fee of reserving the space at Carrboro Commons for that one day a month. It's also worth mentioning that we're organizing it under the nonprofit The Abundance Foundation, for whom I'm employed. It's a sustainability-centered nonprofit in Pittsburgh, and we do a lot around local food, renewable energy, and community. And so it's a perfect fit for the nonprofit and would serve as one of the programs. So that's how we would provide liability insurance and other things. So,
Jackie.
You answered my most difficult question, so thank you. You know, because I was worried about that. If with wild food and food safety, and I know there are regulations with our regular farmers market to make sure that the food's safe. And I know with wild food, a little bit of misidentification can cause some serious problems, like with mushrooms and stuff like that. So I was worried about that. Who would decide who could participate, and would there be a fee for participation?
I guess the application would be designed to make clear a certain level of expectation of the vendor. Myself and Josh, as well as potentially the staff of the Abundance Foundation, could go through the applications and decide who would be accepted and who wouldn't, as for vendors. And your second question?
Would there be a fee to the vendors?
Yes. We were thinking just a very, like, $15 per Sunday per month, or for all 9 months, March through November, which we would be planning to hold it, like a slightly discounted rate. But, yes, yeah.
And would game count as wild food?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, it would, but not in this market. We're not going to have any meat. It's all going to be plant-based materials, just for safety.
Thanks, Jackie. Randy?
Jenny, I want to ask, first of all, I want to thank you and Josh for bringing this to us from the Abundance Foundation. I think it's an awesome area to grow into. And I appreciate Jackie's questions, because that was one of the things I wanted to know. Have you talked with Sarah Blackland with the farmers market, so you have a sense of how that's structured in terms of participation?
Yeah, we've had a couple of meetings with her so far, and she's a big supporter.
Could you come up to the podium and just state, come around the front of the table if you would, and then just state your name just so.
I'm part of the readers.
There are a lot of people who are, well, I don't know about a lot, but there are some people who are watching at home.
Oh, okay, in Australia.
We know Dan's watching.
Dan Wando.
Yeah,
different continents.
So we've met with Sarah a couple times, and she's a big supporter of the market. Doesn't unfortunately have any extra time to help us organize it.
Yeah.
But we're basically looking to her for guidance, and also for we're going to take the application that the Carrboro Farmers Market uses and model our application process upon it.
And another thought, because of the work you want to be doing with the herbs, have you talked with Johnny Randall over at the Botanical Garden and seen about any kind of, partnering you can do with them in terms of the education? And
yeah, that would be great. We have sent out one initial email to 40 possible participants, including the Botanical Garden.
Okay.
And we'd love to work with anyone who wanted to come and had a certain level of expertise.
And
that is something that we're definitely going to consider. We're not going to take someone who took a weekend workshop and thinks they know wild foods. We're going to take people who have a reputation both in the community and resume-wise who know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming up with this project. I think it fits Carrboro very well, and it expands on kind of one of the ways in which Carrboro is known for pushing the envelope on ways to be connected more with our surroundings and expanding the food. So I agree it very much falls in line with the tourist aspect of and with a new hotel and with that agenda item for us. I also want us to think about these kinds of things as opportunities to promote the tourism or those funds, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's a great idea to waive fees for projects like this that are trying to get established. We do support local businesses through the revolving loan fund, but there are in-kind ways that we can support efforts, and I think this is an example of that.
Hi. Yeah, I think your plan sounds like a really neat one. One question I have is did you get the fee? Did you figure the fee based on conversation yet you've had with staff? Or
yeah, the fee for renting the space or the fee charging the vendors?
The fee for renting the space.
Yeah. Go ahead, because you spoke with the staff.
I spoke with Anita and Wendell. I guess a couple weeks ago, and we discussed the fees and terms relating around reserving the space, and they said $125 flat for 0 to 4 hours, I believe.
Okay, all right, and that's. I just wanted to know if you talked with staff yet.
I did, yes.
Okay, well, and one reason is because I know we have some kind of policy where you can have free events for a while or something, right, folks? But the complication here might be either A, because you're taking money from vendors, and or B, maybe you're using electricity in the restrooms and different things like that. So anyway, I guess in that light, what I'd like to suggest, I'd like to make a motion that we refer this to
staff.
Our staff to kind of look it over and figure out a model that will work with you all and us and in terms of something based on the farmer's market and kind of go from there.
And also a timeline, were we to waive over what period of time?
Yeah, we're requesting that for the first year to waive the fee. It would essentially be $1,125, 9 times 125.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we'd be established enough that we'd be able to pay the fee.
Mm-hmm.
And although we could take the $15 per table and apply it toward the rent of the space, it doesn't give us funds to do the advertising that we'd like to do and the other costs that are going to be associated. We are going to look for local sponsors, but we need to establish the date first before we start asking people to sponsor the event.
Sure. And so you're hoping that the first of these events will be when?
March 10th is the date we're out looking
at. Okay. Which seems like it gives us adequate time for staff to respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, the only thing is that we'll have to, of course, enlist all the vendors and do the advertising before that. So as soon as we know that we can use the space, the sooner we can get to other folks who are interested.
Yeah, I don't want to seem like I'm not supporting the idea because I love the idea. It's just my job to ask the hard questions. I'm also would want to be sure that this was okay with the health department.
Yeah, we're going to be following the same model as the farmer's market.
Okay.
There won't be any items
that we're going to have that you won't see at the farmer's market.
Okay.
If that answers your concern.
Good. Good.
Okay. So it has been moved that we refer this to the town staff with the expectation that we'll hopefully take this matter back up as soon as possible so that we can have a decision sufficiently in advance of March. What did you say, 10th?
March 10th, yeah.
Sufficiently in advance of March 10th to allow them some time to promote the event to vendors and others. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. I think this is an exciting concept. I mean, the main question in my mind is how many folks will come and actually participate as vendors. I'm excited to find out what the answer to that question might be.
Yeah, thank you.
So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. So this matter will now be taken up by our town staff to look into the various kind of logistical, legal liability, et cetera, type issues, and hopefully that we get back to us in relatively short order. Do we have email contact information for y'all? Parks and Rec staff is nodding, saying yes, they do.
Yes.
So we'll be in touch with you about when it will come back before us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The other people that I have signed up to speak on various items tonight appear to be speaking on issues that are already on our printed agenda. Is there anybody else here who is here to speak on a matter that is not on our printed agenda? You're on, don't you worry. Brian Russell. All right. Very good. That brings us to resolutions and proclamations. I believe we have a resolution before us. In fact, that brings us to resolutions and proclamations. We have a resolution before us tonight entitled "Resolution Opposing Legislation That Provides for the Forced Taking of Municipal Water Systems." I know a little bit about this. Is there? Have any of the other board members been following this in more detail than I have?
I read a little bit about it, and I was in Nashville when folks were outraged by what's going on up there. So it's a serious problem, but I'm not sure to what extent it applies to us in that we don't have a municipal water system.
Right.
Or even because we don't have or have.
Well, so let's just comment publicly so that those who are listening can know a little bit more about it. I believe the Independent Weekly is going to be having an article this coming week on this particular topic. But apparently, a bill has been introduced in the North Carolina General Assembly, or is proposed, maybe it has been filed or something. Anyway, it's being contemplated by the North Carolina General Assembly, which would authorize the state of North Carolina to take initially from the city of Asheville, from what I understand, but potentially from other municipal governments in North Carolina, their water resources, their reservoirs, their water supply and delivery systems, so that the state would own with, from what I understand, no compensation to the taxpayers of Asheville or potentially other communities, no compensation to them, to the taxpayers or to the ratepayers for the city of Asheville for their investment over many years in their water supply system. The state would be taking over their municipal water supply system with the idea in mind that the state, I guess, some in state government have the idea that they're in a better position than local governments are to make decisions about what should be the fate of those water supply systems.
They could also sell them.
Given the many things that are happening across our country and, frankly, around the world, the concern I have and the reason that I supported putting this item on our agenda is the notion that water supply systems, reservoirs, water lines, water treatment plants that have been created by the public through public investment in creating a high-quality drinking water supply system could be privatized in the future and put into the hands of private investors. At this point, I won't pretend to fully understand where the impetus behind this concept might be coming from. But I think especially for those of us in those of us who are Owassa ratepayers, those of us who live in Chapel Hill and Carborough and nearby who are customers of Owassa, I know that we have invested very heavily in creating the highest quality water system in the entire state of North Carolina, one of the highest quality water systems in the whole country. And the notion that without any compensation to us for our investment, without any consent from us as consumers, that resource might be taken away from us by the state and potentially put into the hands of Wall Street or other private investors is extremely concerning. And so I would ask that the Board of Aldermen move this resolution opposing legislation that provides for the force taking of municipal water systems with the town of Carborough and Owassa as appropriate filled into the blanks in the resolution.
So moved. So
second. And I'd just like to make one more point that, you know, one way in this which this could be taken advantage of is fracking.
Fracking is a major
user of water, and
that's right.
So and fracking is in our vicinity, so it could very in
so
real
even
terms
if they didn't privatize it, they could say, yeah, you can use this water for fracking.
Mark, did the city of Asheville send this out to all the municipalities or how did this come to us?
This was the league, I think.
I believe the city and/or the league, working in partnership, have kind of brought this situation to our attention.
Is this something where should we unanimously agree that we can generate a letter to other municipalities in the state? Asking them to join with us to support Asheville. I really feel that just having the league, the League of Municipalities, make the request, or even the City of Asheville, I think it needs a groundswell of municipalities.
I think it makes sense for us to follow up this resolution with a letter to the league and ask them to use their networks to draw attention to it and to circulate the information to other communities. I will say that some similar issues arose for entirely different reasons in the late 1960s in North Carolina. And our attorney would know better than me, but I believe that as sort of shocking as this concept is, that it's pretty clear under North Carolina law that the legislature does have the authority to do something along these lines. We may not like to think of ourselves as being entirely subservient to our legislature or what have you, but our municipalities are created and exist only at the pleasure of our state legislature. Mm-hmm. And so while all the details might be perhaps a little bit murky, that the reality is that we were created by the state government, and we can those things that we have created can be taken away by the state government. And so this is extremely concerning. The only And I'll also point out, I think, perhaps the only source of optimism about this issue is the fact that although there are plenty of issues that our new governor and I disagree upon, that our new governor is a former mayor and somebody who spent a great deal of time over the last decade advocating for the rights of municipalities. Mm-hmm. And we hope that that he has not forgotten his roots in that respect, and that he will continue to support the independence of municipalities and the rights of municipalities when it comes to their relationship to our state government. So is there a motion? Has there already been?
Yeah,
a,
there was.
There was already a motion.
Yeah, and seconded.
Second? Okay, very good. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, Honor passed unanimously.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you also to
Kathy.
Kathy and the town manager and whoever else was involved in making sure that this got onto our agenda for this week. All right. Now, at last, that brings us to our regular agenda, our consent agenda, item D. Mr. Manager.
Mr. Mayor, thank you, Mr. Mayor, and members of the Board of Aldermen. There are five items on your consent agenda, one being the minutes from your December 4th, 2012 meeting, also a street closing permit application for the Kidney Care 5K Run Walk, the annual certification of the Carbo Fire Rescue Department's roster. Item four is an amendment to the preliminary engineering contract for the Morgan Creek Greenway. And the fifth item is the draft 2014-2020 Transportation Improvement Plan, a.k.a. the TIP.
Yeah, I've got a question on number three and on number four.
And I just wanted to make a comment that for number one, the adjusted minutes, we had gotten an email about the adjustments to the meeting minutes.
Okay, so that's a motion for items 1, 2, and 5 with the corrected minutes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's vote on 1, 2, and 5. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, matter passed unanimously. What was your question, Sammy, on number 3?
Not necessarily to be answered on this item, but just interest in pension funds generally in North Carolina. Maybe this is a an ask to the league or into our legislators. Not that we have much traction on it, but there's a big movement to divest from fossil fuel companies that are part of pension funds. And so I'd be curious to find out what kind of investments are being made through these pension funds, and if they are problematic, finding out ways in which we could ask for consideration of these issues. And for item number four, I noticed that there was a need for permitting with FEMA, and I wasn't sure that was needed given that we're using the existing bridge. So unless it's needed just because we're going to have construction in the floodplain. I was just curious as to whether that is actually going to be needed.
No, actually, Sammy, the bridge that was originally proposed cannot be built.
Right. So we're going to use the current road. So my question is, why do we need FEMA to do permitting work when we're not using that?
Could staff address that second question first, maybe, about the FEMA permitting issue?
Thought because of the realignment that we did not need the FEMA, but maybe Jeff can clarify.
So it is true that the consultant provided an opinion on FEMA permitting for the first bridge between Berry Hill and Canterbury. And their opinion was that it would not be permitted by FEMA. So that's been decided, and that's kind of what led to the on-bridge facility option. But if you recall, that included in the scope of this contract was the need to pursue FEMA documentation for the other crossings upstream, it would be, for the future length of the greenway.
Okay.
So we...
So when you say the upstream, so that would be up in the vicinity of...
Rosewalk and the tennis club.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
If we get that far.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But if exactly. we do those things right now, it'll save us a lot of trouble
right.
later.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Okay. And with regard to Sammy's second question, maybe the staff could respond to us in writing at a later time, since I'm sure off the top of your head you don't necessarily know. But
the pension fund?
Or? About the pension fund
yeah.
issue.
We can research that and find out, you know, what, you know, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
They should have a prospectus.
So I'll move both those items.
All right, there's been a motion for items 3 and 4. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. That brings us to item E1, a public hearing on a resolution establishing a hotel room occupancy tax. Okay. Mr. Manager.
Mr. Bear, I believe y'all put this on December the 4th, but technically there should have been a public hearing, and I think, Mike, if you want to comment, I think that the idea was to have the public hearing now. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean that we overlooked the requirement that there be a public hearing on it. Y'all to discuss it, and so I mean that this is a really kind of a formality that we're going through. Although obviously it's a public hearing, anyone can speak on it. So I mean that's what we're here to do.
Okay. And just can you refresh my recollection regarding the? I'm not sure whether I should ask this question in this agenda item or the next one, but in connection with the establishment of the hotel room occupancy tax, we have to establish a board that will make, well, a tourism development authority board or something like that it's called.
Yes.
Which is a volunteer board that would make they would make decisions about how the money is spent from the tax. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. The statute that we're required to operate under is required that you establish the Tourism Development Authority, and does provide that the proceeds, the town collects the taxes, turns it over to the Tourism Development Authority, and they then disperse the funds. And they are required to disperse them in accordance with the provisions of the statute. And I'm looking for that specific division of the way it has to, the way they have to be spent. One-third has to be spent on, where is that?
One-third on his or promotion, is that right?
There you go, okay. Two-thirds have to be remitted to promote travel and tourism.
Two-thirds on promotion.
Promotion and one-third on one-third on tourism-related expenditures, both of which are defined terms.
Okay.
So one-third for tourism-related expenditures and two-thirds for tourism for marketing. So
and correct me if I'm wrong. My recollection is the expectation has been up to this point that the portion that would go to visitor services is for the first 5 years of the existence of this hotel going to be spent on paying for the lease on parking spaces in the parking deck.
That
is that
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
That is correct.
And although this board here has sort of always had that assumption that's been what we've done thus far sort of predicated on that assumption.
Yes.
That actually the decision about that will be in the hands of this Tourism Development Authority. Is that right?
Yes. I think the sort of working assumption, if you could characterize it, is that the one-third of the funds that are required to be spent on tourism-related expenditures would be, as you say, devoted to, at least for the first 5 years, to the payment or to assist in the payment that the town is contracted to make to the parking facility that's being constructed. So that's where those, in other words, those funds are, they have to be, formally they have to be budgeted and appropriated by the Tourism Development Authority. But the working assumption has been that the one-third that is required to be spent on tourism-related expenditures would be going to in that direction. There has also been at least some comment or discussion or maybe working assumption that the other two-thirds to promote travel and tourism would be likely to be appropriated to the counties, whatever they're
the
called.
Chapel Hill. Orange County, Chapel Hill.
The entity is already established and pursuant to some contract, which leads to the other further assumption. The way that this thing is structured is by creating, originally was drafted to have a three-person board. The last meeting, the board directed that that be enlarged to a five-person board, but sort of the underlying issue there is the extent to which this board is to be perceived as operating effectively as an independent board as opposed to a board that is, how can I put it, highly responsive to the direction of this board. And
we like highly responsive boards.
Well, it was for that reason that when I drafted it, we made it a three-person board with one-year terms, the members of which can be relieved at any time for any reason. In other words, and I think that has some bearing upon the number of board members that you wish to establish, because if one is volunteering to be a member of this board, it presumably would be of interest to know whether or not there is going to be any substantial decisions and policy decisions that they're going to make, or are they going to be, as I said, highly responsive to this board's direction as to where those funds ought to be spent, meeting once or twice a year to ratify what you have requested them to do. It was in that direction that I structured the initial draft of this ordinance. So if you want to expand it from to expand it to five persons, kind of reflects perhaps a different expectation of what the board's duties would be. In other words, to expand it to five persons sort of reflects a concept that they would be perhaps more independently minded and would have more discretion in deciding where these funds are going to be spent. So that's kind of the issue that plays out in terms of the number of board members.
The other thing that I think is maybe really relevant to understand here is the state legislation the action the state legislature took that authorizes us to have this tax requires that some of the members of the Tourism Development Authority be essentially hoteliers. I mean, people who work in the hotel industry. Is that right?
That's correct. At least one third of the members must be individuals who are affiliated with businesses that collect the tax in the town, i.e., the hotels. In which case, you can take the S off our hotels. We've got one hotel, and so one third of the members must be individuals who are affiliated with businesses that collect it. So, a three-person board, you'd have to have one member basically who represents the hotel. And then at least three-fourths of the members must be individuals who are currently active in the promotion of travelers and tourism. So you'd have to have, given the fact that the way I would perceive it, that the member who is representing the hotel also qualifies as someone who is currently active in the promotion of travel and tourism. With a three-person board, essentially you have one representative of the hotel and two other people who are also engaged in the promotion of travel and tourism, which from my perspective would be anybody who's engaged in a business that brings people from outside the town, you know, restaurants and the art center and other businesses and, you know, there's lots of, you know.
The comedy theater.
The list goes on and on. I don't think that's a long list. The one-third is a short list. You've got Representative Hotel and the two. And the same, if it was two, if it was a five-person board, it would have to be at least two representatives from the hotel and three other sorts of persons. But
okay.
I think it really, the three versus five issue, I think really is an issue that reflects your desire to have them be more or less independent.
Okay. I have one person signed up to speak, but
Jackie. It had been ever since we started talking about the hotel, because I've known about this money for longer than we've been talking about the hotel, I was hoping that some could actually really go towards the arts and, like, to help offset the cost of our festivals or to go to different arts events and music events, because those draw tourists. But it looks like under the current configuration that it'll go towards the parking and towards an agency, and there really won't be any to use for arts and entertainment directly in the town.
I think that's the implication of what the attorney's telling you for the first five years.
Yeah.
Well, I was saying that was what was contemplated, although, as you read the definition of the two-thirds that must be spent on promoting travel and tourism, to advertise or market an area or activity, publish and distribute pamphlets and other materials, conduct market research, or engage in promotional activities that attract tourists or business travelers to the area. Seems to me the music festival and all those things could be part of what would advertising and marketing for that. Now, if you're thinking more in terms of appropriations to specific artists or grants, or so, I don't think it falls in that category, but it seems to me that anything that involves promotions of the various festivals and activities that we've sponsored and co-sponsored could easily fall within the promote travel and tourism area, and that would be something that you would engage, well, again, what wasn't contemplated as opposed to setting up some separate staffing system or something, that there is an organization that apparently I've heard this board say does good work and for Carborough, and basically this would be involved presumably funding by contract with them to do specific things for Carborough with the money that would be transferred.
But the very last line of that says, to me, leads me to believe that events which draw people to the area could also be underwritten with this.
Well, from which portion, though? Because here's the thing: let's like really get it down to brass tacks. For example, one of the issues with say the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival, which is coming up shortly, is that they from time to time would like to be able to use some of the town's facilities in holding some of the events in connection with the festival. So the fees that are associated with renting those spaces, actually whether it's from the town or from some other, from the Cat's Cradle or whatever, those fees are not promotion. They're not visitor promotion. They do qualify as visitor services, but they don't qualify as visitor promotion. Because visitor promotion is really meaning, at some level, basically things that amount to advertising.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're correct, but I guess what this sort of reflects is the conceptual issue of whether this board's expectation is that those kinds of decisions are going to be made by this board, by this board that you're setting up, or by this board that's on
we're going to kind of substitute our
judgment. Number three says tourism-related expenditures that in the judgment of the authority are designed to increase the use of lodging facilities, meeting facilities, by attracting tourist or business travelers to the town. This term includes tourism-related capital expenditures. So the comedy festival, the film festival, they draw visitors to the town. They draw people who would stay in the hotel, the people who are going to be performing in the comedy festival, people who are going to be showing films in the film festival, they would stay in the hotel. That's why I thought that one would let us spend money on those
events.
Well,
I think it probably would. That's in the one-third of tourism-related expenditures.
Right.
And I've just said that in earlier discussions by this board about this topic, the expectation or the discussion was that those funds would be going to the parking. There's no formal commitment to do that. I mean, you could change that at any time.
No, we have a commitment. It's not formal.
Well, you have a commitment to make the expenditures, but let's say the appropriation is committed, but the source of the funds for the appropriation is not committed.
Main Street Partners doesn't care where the money comes
from,
as long as the money comes.
No.
Well, we have to be sure the money comes.
So really there's no money to spend. Really there won't be any money to spend directly on the arts. For instance, I know the film festival is now to the point where it could really use somebody who's getting paid a stipend to do that. And the film festival does draw people. Yeah.
Right.
So we couldn't use the money for things like that.
I'm not sure
that I would agree that you couldn't use it.
Hold on. Go ahead, Mr. Attorney.
This has to be sort of fleshed out. The two categories are not. There's not an absolutely bright line between them, nor is the language sufficiently clear that the boundaries of it are fully established. So I think. Certainly, in the tourism-related expenditures, if that kind of expenditure were to be made, I think it would be in that category. But that's the category where there has been an articulation of an expectation that those funds would be going in that direction.
Right.
But as the mayor says, as long as the check cashes, they probably don't care where the source of funds is.
Yeah. Okay. Sammy, and then Annette, if you have anything to add to that. No. Okay. Sammy, and then Lydia.
So I think the key here is that this a lot of this is in the judgment of this body that we'd be creating. So whoever we put on there would be hopefully folks who reflect the values of the arts and or I would propose also the local living economy. That draws tourism too. Piedmont Biofuels, for example, in Pittsburgh attracts people from all over the area, and we're a sustainable community that have that kind of thing too. I guess the other question I had a little more explicit about our commitment to the funds for the parking deck. In theory, then, what you're saying is that if we chose the wrong people who didn't honor that commitment, then we would be left holding the bag and needing to find that money elsewhere.
Yes, but the way the attorney has drafted this, we can fix that problem.
Yes, I mean, clearly this... the draft of this the ordinance, a resolution that establishes the Tourism Development Authority, did not contemplate a model similar to use the other example of WASA, where they, it's the expectations. It's a kind of a fully independent board. Admittedly, they're supposed to reflect our representatives. We only have two people on that and reflect the goals and aspirations of this board. But the Tourism Development Authority is either three, four, or five, whatever you choose, three-person board with one-year terms that can be removed at any time. So I would fully expect that they would be adhering closely to your recommendations as to how the funds be spent. But, how you – the expectations that you put on that board are going to be your expectations. I do think it whether it's a three-person board or, or a five-person board, kind of reflects that orientation from my perspective.
Right.
If it's a three-person board, it kind of says, I don't want to use the term rubber stamp, but it does come to mind. Whereas if it's a five-person board, it's a little more independently oriented. Still reflecting your personal values and policies, but it's a difference between are we going to meet monthly or whatever and engage in these kind of discussions, and we're going to be contracting with the Orange County Chapel Hill Tourism Board, or is pretty much this board going to say this is what's going to happen, and you're here to help us make it happen.
Okay, Lydia, and then Lori Palcelli.
Right. I want to just quickly say for anyone who might be watching or anyone in the audience that who kind of wonders why we've already, at least this board in theory, has committed these tourism-related expenditures for the next 5 years, is the reality was that was what made the project move forward. The decision by us to kind of anticipate those hotel taxes and understand that this arrangement, which I believe Mark kind of worked up or figured out on a trip with the Chamber to Asheville or something, that was a way we could get this project underway and going and sustainable and built. So if this were not the way we had set it up, we might not even have the hotel tax to even think about right now. So just wanted to make that point before Laurie.
Yeah, I think it is worth realizing that without the commitment we made to the parking deck and our relationship with 300 East Main Street, there would be no hotel. And it was some clarity about that that got us to where we are now. Mm-hmm. Laurie, do you want to?
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Laurie Policelli, and thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm the director of the Orange County Visitor Bureau. And as we can see tonight, this is an issue that can get a little bit confusing in terms of our ability to levy taxes in Orange County and Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And so I'm here tonight as staff, and I emphasize as staff because I ultimately report to a county manager and a board of county commissioners who this group works with. So anything I say tonight could easily be Trump tomorrow. So I just offer my I just offer my unique experience from the perch I sit on, and I'm here really as a courtesy to answer any questions because it is a little bit confusing. Tourism was really an initiative of the county commissioners 20 years ago. They elected with the state statutes to tax visitors to our town so that they could grow the economy and not have any burden on the property tax owner. I don't think 20 years ago the county commissioners really saw how explosive tourism could be in Orange County. Today, they levy a 3% tax on all hotels, which will include Carrboro, and they also, the state allows the cities to levy a 3% tax. So combined, as long as we're not charging our hotel guests more than 6%, we're good. Carrboro has a really wonderful opportunity right now in tourism. Carrboro is a highly sought-after destination. Carrboro is our edge. Carrboro is cool. I wish I could be more eloquent than that. But Carrboro really has...
That'll do.
Carrboro is really sought after for the arts, for festivals, for restaurants, for food, and for its loafability. You know, that's an intangible. That's not a Disney or a Grand Ole Opry. But you have people coming here because it's a comfortable place to loaf. There's a respect for individualism here. And it really is a site that's very sought after by travelers. So your unique position now to tax visitors and grow your tourism marketing is remarkable, and I applaud you on that. What we do at the county, to my knowledge, will not change. The county will have its 3% tax on your hotel, and the county's edict to us and to me as executive director is make sure that you are coordinating the assets that Carrboro offers in our effort to lure more tourists here. So what that means is that we will continue to support financially the film festival. We will continue to support financially the music festival. We will continue to photograph Carrboro through Don Young, our award-winning photographer. We will continue to provide videography of Carrboro through Nick Beery. We will continue to partner with Carrboro Day and related adventures. We have Lydia Lavelle on our board who provides oversight to our decisions. We have Annette on our board who's a wonderful asset to our group. I don't believe that your tax and your hotel and your initiative is an either or, a TDA or an Orange County Visitor Bureau. From where I sit, it's really in addition to. Our agency will continue to promote Carrboro in every way that we can. And I won't dispute the parking issue because parking is a very powerful word around here. And what I don't know about parking is a lot. So what you have going on with parking, I won't dispute that and I won't go there. But I will say that you have a niche market here that is very deserving of promotion. And I hope, I would love to see you use those dollars for marketing. I would love to see the arts center and a hotelier and a restaurateur represented on your TDA with Annette. My concern, if I have any concern at all, it's a win-win concern. If we're supporting festivals and advertising in the Indy and Wilmington Star, et cetera, I want to make sure that we're not duplicating any of those efforts. So I will definitely make sure that, you know, we have a direct line to Annette. But, you know, our decisions are very marketing sound. They're not always politically accepted. And I'll just say it. We do advertise Chapel Hill. And when we talk to our potential visitors about coming to this area, they identify the area as Chapel Hill. I do not believe Chapel Hill and Carrboro would be as spectacular without each other. There is an interdependence there that we all know and feel. And oftentimes when we talk about Carrboro, it's in the Chapel Hill News. It's in the Chapel Hill Herald. The Carrboro Citizen would talk about Chapel Hill. My daughter goes to Carrboro High, and I'm a Chapel Hill resident. So the dependence on each other is a win-win. But I understand where that large Visit Chapel Hill nomenclature and brand does upset some people. So our goal is to continue to promote that way, bring people in, and really hope that you will use those funds to promote the uniqueness of Carrboro once they're here. So if I can answer any questions, I think it's all good. You know, I'm grateful for the county for making these funds available to all of us. We try really hard. You know, we hit some out of the ballpark, and our successes are encouraging, with $154 million being spent here by tourists last year and nearly 1,700 jobs. So it's an industry that we can all be proud of, and it's a new chapter for you, and we're here to support that. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Lori. I don't have any questions on that, but I do have a comment on it, which is, you know, I think it's sometimes tempting to, you know, it maybe can be a little bit frustrating in some ways to some of us who live in Carrboro and who are so dedicated to this community to sometimes see Bon Appetit or some of these other national publications recognize Chapel Hill or Durham or the Durham Chapel Hill area for their outstanding restaurants, but then when you read the text of it, the restaurants they're talking about are not in Chapel Hill.
Right.
They're in Carrboro. But at the same time, you know, we also do get a fair amount of attention on our own, and I think it. To me, it makes sense for our community to capitalize on the recognizability of the name of our dear neighbors to the east. But at the same time, be promoting our individuality and our separateness from Chapel Hill. And I think, you know, much of the work that you and everyone at the Visitors Bureau have done or have been doing over the last several years have helped to make that clear. Our State Magazine prominently featured an article on Carrboro as a unique visitor destination not too long ago, and I believe within the I don't know whether it's the next issue or the issue after that, but shortly, Southern Living Magazine, for example, which is maybe some of y'all don't read Southern Living. I know I don't. But it is a magazine with a very wide circulation in the United States and certainly in the South, is going to be featuring an article on Carrboro, especially emphasizing our restaurants and explicitly covering Johnny's, Jesse's, Open Eye, Southern Rail, Acme, Neil's Deli, absolutely. Neil's on their own have been attracting national, even global attention. Anyway, I wanted to just say thank you to you and to your staff for the role that y'all have played in helping to kind of make sure our our identity as a town separate from our neighbors is out there and is something we're also promoting. And I think that this new tax is going to be an opportunity to only kind of push that further. Not that we should focus exclusively on the notion of promoting ourselves separately from Chapel Hill, but that we should be both capitalizing on the reputation of our neighbors, really more than anything on the reputation of the university that I think both our towns share, and at the same time on our kind of unique and separate identity as a town. So thank you for all that you do for our community.
Yes.
Randy.
Lori, I know that that Annette and the Economic Sustainability Commission have been working on a board of objective on branding, and I'm just wondering if once Carver kind of solidifies its brand and wants to get it out there, if the Orange County Visitors Bureau would work with the town of Carver to help, you know, get the message out there and broadcast it for us, because I think that that's going to be that's part of this, but I'm wondering if that's something that as it gets launched, if you would partner with us in that.
Absolutely. I think that's the only way we can really do it. I think if one town is successful, we're all successful in Orange County. Annette works very closely with us. She monitors our research and sees that the average person to Carver is 49, from the state, here for the day, here for arts, here for food. And I know she's building a brand to create greater awareness of that. So there will definitely be synergies there. Yes.
Jackie.
I had a suggestion and then a question.
Yes.
I think a good slogan would be Chapel Hill, walking distance to Carborough, or one that was Carborough, what Chapel Hill thinks it is. Either of those, I think would be good. But if we decide to allocate the money the way it's proposed, that's a significant amount of money. What would be happening as far as your relationship with Carborough that would be different with that increased infusion of funds?
If the TDA funds went to the Visitor Bureau?
Yes.
Well, really our model for success right now is to fill that hotel, and largely because the hotel guest leaves 25 cents of their dollar at the hotel. So the rest of those dollars go on your streets. They go to the art center, the restaurant, gas stations, et cetera. So when we sit down with the hoteliers, we ask them what their plan is and how we can augment. You won't have any trouble on weekends at all. That hotel will be full on weekends. It will be very popular with UNC, athletics, weddings. Where they'll struggle is midweek, Sunday through Thursday. Mm-hmm. And it's where all of us are struggling right now. So our plan largely is based on some things that are very strategic. We will look at the Sunday through Thursday market and spend a lot of money going after bicycle associations, Glaxo, Quintile. We'll try to bring those groups in. And we really, you know, I'm staff, but I really believe that having your TDA build a Carborough brand and then volley that to us to put into the larger Orange County cell is really a win-win. And I think you have your finger on the pulse of what Carborough needs and desires to be successful and to really meet the edicts and ethos of what you stand for. And so I think it will be, in the beginning, working very hand-in-hand with the county's 3% and Otma Development to say, what do we have to do to fill this hotel? And then working with supporting the NEA grant if that comes through, because arts, you're right, is critical, and also your evening economies. I mean, Carborough, I think, sets the tone for nightlife in this county. So there's a lot of opportunity, but you're here. You live it. You see it. Annette does, Lydia does. They input these suggestions in our board. And so I really think that with what we do strategically in group sales, motor coach sales, wedding sales, will be our part of it. And then Annette's brand will fit into the bigger picture. And I think with that, and to Mark's point, to Mayor Chilton's point, I've only been here 7 years, but when I started, I get why people called Carborough Chapel Hill, and it wasn't an intentional slight at all. If you're having people visit and their hotels are listed in Chapel Hill, sometimes they just think they're in Chapel Hill.
But part of that is I've been on this board for over 22 years, and for years and years and years, this conversation's been going on. And I think if 22 years ago people had acknowledged Carborough instead of giving Chapel Hill credit for a lot of what's Carborough, our brand would be established. You know, and I'm really kind of tired of being in the junior position, but we have a long meeting tonight, so I don't need
I think the brand is established, and I think it's very positive, and I think that it's just getting more and more and more
popular.
But
the hotel's advertising itself as Chapel Hill. Anyway, we can get into that later.
We'll.
Yeah.
I think all the things we're talking about tonight help to will help to eventually change that. And you know, I'll say this: I don't know. I've been involved in local government for 2 years less than you, Jackie, which means close to eternity. And I don't know how many meetings I've been at where people have said, Chapel Hill, Carborough, what's the difference? Nobody even knows where the town line is. And what I've noticed is that it's always people who live in Chapel Hill who say that, and it's never people who live in Carborough.
Yeah.
Well,
we have better
you know, the fact is, the fact is, the reality is that until you've been here, it seems like it's one place.
Mm-hmm.
But
and there
that
are,
once you have been here, you appreciate how this community is different than our the one that's just a mile to our east.
Right.
And, I think that's a situation that will continue to evolve. And
Has evolved, like Chapel Hill's relationship to the Triangle. I think that when I look at the meetings we've had lately and the clients we've had in, coming through the state's RTP office, the Triangle, you know, there is Chapel Hill and there is the Triangle. Carborough is very different from Chapel Hill. Carborough very much has its own identity. And I think through the work of this board, Annette, well, really mostly, honestly, through the restaurants, the arts, the coffee shops, you have a winning
situation.
What
those folks were talking about just
exactly
an hour ago, you know, I mean, that's the type of stuff that puts us on the map. You heard what they said. There's not one example of that kind of market in the entire nation.
Yes.
Let's capitalize on it.
Absolutely. And I am a Jaguar mom. But anyway, it's all good, and we're here to help, and I appreciate it.
I think some of the details of this will be spelled out in whatever that contractual relationship is that the Tourism Development Authority will help us to establish. Sammy, and then let's.
I mean, I think I agree. Like, we are all benefiting, even if it is Carborough that is promoted to attract people to Chapel Hill, and then they come to Carborough and they don't even know it. But we should take it as an honor. Like, souls are invisible, you know. So. Carborough, Chapel of Souls.
There you go.
Well, thank you, and I hope our good work is helping. We Film Festival is huge for us. Our relationship with folks like Jackie Helvey and Nick Beery and the coffee shops and Neil's Deli and the authors, and, it's a daily effort for us, and I think our results are encouraging, and I hope that the TDA is a successful and that we can continue down this tourism partnership route.
All right. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Mark, I had a question for you.
Yes.
About this.
Me?
Yeah. That five-year, the first 5 years for the parking deck, is that something that beyond that the money could be designated to go to particular arts? I'm thinking about what Jackie was saying. Or is that something we can make sure to have the board, the future board revisit to...
Well, right, yeah, so absolutely. It'll be something that'll be up to the TDA and therefore indirectly the Board of Aldermen to decide after the 5 years. For sure, there's never been any expectation that our relationship with 300 East Main Street will extend beyond that 5 years in any way. So, yeah, once that 5 years is up, which it's 2013, so that'll be basically like fiscal year 2018-19.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be a bunch of new resources for visitor services or visitor promotion that'll be available starting in that year.
I'm bringing it up then.
is that language we want in the resolution at this point, though, or?
I'll remember.
Jack, you'll be here. Don't worry about it.
Are we going to change the makeup of the board?
I'm going to make a motion.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. And assuming the public hearing's closed.
It hasn't been really opened yet, so.
Yeah. Oh, well, is there anybody from the public who, besides Lori, who would like to speak on this matter? All right. Very good. Thank you. Is the resolution really a part of item E1?
No. It is. E1 is the adoption of the resolution, and okay. The next one will be the application.
That's correct.
But okay. I'd like to move the adoption of the resolution, but I think based on our conversation, I'd like to suggest that the CTDA consists of 3 members rather than 5.
Okay. Very good. So it has been moved, and is there a second?
I'll second.
A second from Randy, that we establish the TDA with 3 members. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
And that would establish the hotel and move the whole resolution establishing the tax.
Establishing the TDA and the tax.
Yeah.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Because they were 2 separate agenda items.
Right.
Both matters pass unanimously.
Well, I have a comment about the next agenda item just quickly.
Go ahead.
Are we on it now, the application?
Yes. Go ahead.
I just thought that on the application, I know we added a line that said provide examples of how you're involved in the promotion of travel and tourism, I guess to make sure that they fit that particular, that the applicant fits that part of the requirements for the members. I thought you might want to add a sentence that says, are you an individual affiliated with a business that collects tax in the town, just to see if they fit that category? It might not always be a name that we know necessarily as someone that does fit that category. So do you understand what I'm saying, Kathy?
The occupancy tax.
When we get our second hotel, we'll know which one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there might be other people that work there, but they don't recognize the name.
Or
B&B.
It's possible that a B&B could have.
But I would add that line on there, I think, Kathy.
Okay. And just to draw to your attention, there were some other changes to the application. One, specifically, we're not calling it the advisory board application anymore because they're not all advisory boards, mm-hmm. haven't been for some time.
Right.
And then on the back page, just some questions about which term they're applying for. If it is a 3rd consecutive term, mm-hmm. ask for a reason to be appointed.
Good, mm-hmm. good thinking. So. Okay. All right. I don't know that we need a motion on that. I think it's.
I just have a quick question on item 2 in the second piece here. It says to advertise or market an area or activity. What is meant by those terms? Is that just.
And so we're.
Area or activity, what?
On the last page of item F1. Number 2, the second sentence says to advertise or market an area or activity. Is that just sounds like
to advertise or market an area or activity, publish and distribute pamphlets or other things you can do.
An area would be like our downtown.
Oh, an area meaning
like a physical
meaning
space.
Carrier, yeah. Meaning Carborough.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just straight from the. And that's the same language that was in
on
the
this
first
one right here.
Okay.
So I guess I'll move. Let me make a motion to move that resolution then also.
Okay. Which resolution is that?
For the application.
Okay. It's been moved. Is there a second for the resolution on the application?
I second it.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. I think that takes care of both E1 and F1.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to item F2. Excuse me for just a moment. Our new mayor pro tem will preside.
Thank you, Marty Booth, and staff report.
Good evening, everyone. Shall I proceed or wait on the mayor?
Okay. Oh, he said, excuse me. Okay. So we're here to discuss Johnny's at 901 West Main Street, report on the letter of agreement, and discuss an approach we've identified to move forward. I'm going to give a relatively brief presentation and then just open it up to questions if there are any. Brief history of the property and the use of the land is included in the agenda item abstract. In short, the property is residentially zoned, but grandfathered as a non-conforming retail use, has been used as various retail outlets over the years. The more recent history within the past few years includes an application to rezone the property to a commercial district and seek a land use permit under the commercial zoning. And there was a lot of back and forth about that, a lot of discussion with neighbors and neighborhood meeting and all of that. And ultimately, the discussion surrounding the application led to the idea of using mediation or a facilitated meeting, some approach of along those lines that might, thank you, some approach along those lines that might bring it to a public hearing with some level of consensus or identified points of agreement, something along those lines. And eventually, the property owner and a representative group of neighbors met of their own efforts and began discussing just in individual meetings amongst themselves what were mutually acceptable uses of the land, what things weren't acceptable, and they met on an occasion and ultimately summarized points of agreement in a letter that was submitted to the board for consideration. And the board referred that matter to staff, referred the letter to staff, and over the holidays, during the board's break, the staff did consider the letter and tried to identify a way that, to the degree that there was agreement between the owner and this representative group of neighbors, a way that we could solidify or formalize that into an actual permit and have something rather under permit rather than just this grandfathered retail use with questions of whether something should or could or would be accessory use of the land or not. So we did ultimately identify a way to do that under Land Use Ordinance Section 15-126. It involves issuing a zoning permit, and we will, assuming this does move forward in this manner, we'll include all the agreed-upon terms as a part of the permit, and that will thereby establish parameters for what is acceptable on the site under the established grandfather retail use. It would add one use to the permit itself, which would be an open-air market use, and some of the agreed-upon terms limit how much of that, how large those could be, and things of that nature. A supplemental updated agreement was submitted to staff yesterday, so those additional terms will also be included in issuing the permit. And I have here, just for reference, the original letter that the board received prior to Christmas, and then the updated one that came in today. And it's really just additional details and clarification. There are the owner, management, and neighbors, representative neighbors are here tonight. So if there is any disagreement, I assume we'll hear about it. But otherwise, as far as I know, standing here in front of you, these are all mutually agreed upon terms and parameters, and we'll incorporate them into the permit moving forward. So next steps, assuming we do move forward here in this manner, property owner will need to submit a land use permit application as outlined under 15-126. The staff will need to conduct a review of the application. We'll need to send it out to review agencies and kind of inform them of the path forward here. I don't anticipate it being a lengthy review. The whole idea is that the ordinance does allow non-conforming situations to remain in place in certain situations. So the application would effectively ask to just leave everything in place and establish the parameters that are outlined in the letter. So I don't anticipate that taking a too long a time, but we do need to do it to officially notify all the agencies of how this is coming to a conclusion. Meanwhile, the board may wish to consider adopting the attached resolution found in the packet, your packet tonight. And there's also the matter of the previously scheduled public hearing date for February, which you may wish to discuss. Again, the owner, management, and some number of neighbors are here. I'm not aware of anyone having a specific presentation or comments, but I'm open to questions, and I assume they would be too, or perhaps they want to say something, but I'm not aware of it.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you.
First, members of the board, anyone have any questions or comments?
I think I had one question on, we did receive an email about concern for the loudness of the food trucks at times, and the question of if there's a way in which to, beyond the curfew constraints that are already going to be in place, make sure that food trucks are plugged in so that those noises aren't affecting the neighbors?
The owner or management could perhaps speak to that, but I believe that has been handled as a private matter without town involvement so far.
Okay.
All right.
This is probably a technical question. So there would not be a permit, an ABC permit, for on-premises alcohol consumption, correct?
That's correct. Tastings, technically.
Okay. So my second question is, how can you have tastings if there's no on-premises alcohol permitted?
It's a specific permit that allows for limited amounts of alcohol to be given away. There's no money exchanged. There are parameters, state level ABC parameters, okay, and regulations relating to that. So it's a separate permit from on-site sales.
Okay, thank you.
As a nonprofit, Carver Green Space used to be able to have events with alcohol through that mechanism, I think.
All right, other questions or comments, members of the board? Randy?
I was wanting to know if the folks who came together and cobbled this so nicely had anything to share with the public.
Yeah, does anyone want to come up and speak to the matter, or? Okay.
Come on up.
I would like to just thank the neighbors and the owner and the new manager for coming together and talking with us and coming together to these agreements, and also just ask the board to move this along quickly at this point, because I think that they've been struggling now with trying to keep a business going there. And I think we've identified a lot of things that would be really good for the community. And that includes even being able to have small things going on inside. And I've talked a lot with the neighbors right around there. And so I just ask you now to move this forward, in a fairly expedited manner. And because we've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I saw that February 26th date on there, and that was a little concerning.
No, I think that's something we'll be canceling.
Okay,
so, no,
all right.
We're good.
So, and I think that we're willing to work together to iron out any of the other things. So,
well, that's wonderful to hear.
No, it is. It is. Thank you very much.
So, yeah.
Okay, members of the board, then, if I could have a motion to receive the report and consider and perhaps to adopt the resolution attached.
So moved.
Moved by second. Randy, second by Sammy. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now, I think the matter that was up there was, is this right, Mr. Manager? Do we have a public hearing kind of tentatively scheduled for the end of February that was already on the books for this matter before this agreement came about?
You did have one scheduled for February the 26th, and I believe this may have canceled it. Or
you can vote or to cancel it's, it now.
I think that's the point, board members, that it doesn't make any sense to still have that public hearing scheduled.
Well, is there a date when we could have the public hearing sooner? I know
there is no need for a public hearing now given the action that has
You're
been
right.
taken. So you just need to cancel the public hearing.
Cancel the public hearing.
Expedite this and get it going.
Right. Yeah, the public hearing wasn't if we were going to rezone, but now right. that we voted to agree on the zoning permit,
okay,
then
right.
we don't need to have it.
Okay.
So do we need a motion?
So do we? Let's have a motion.
I'll move to cancel that public hearing.
Second.
Okay, moved by Sammy and second by Jackie. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Why don't you all have a toast right. somewhere?
Thank you all.
But don't disturb
the
neighbors. Yeah. Don't be too loud. Yeah.
A small free toast that Johnny's.
All right. Who on this item now? We're in the seat.
All right. That brings us to item F3, a discussion of options related to filling a vacancy on the Carver Board of Aldermen. Mr. Manager, do you have a presentation on this?
Kathy's going to just give you an outline of what your options are.
Madam Clerk.
Thank you, Mayor and Board. You have before you a resolution asking you to set a special election to fill the vacancy of Dan Coleman. There are two options for when you can set that special election. One is the months preceding November, which is when the regular municipal election is scheduled for, except in the months of July and August. I have before you, I believe, 15 Tuesdays. Tuesday was selected because that's the normal election day there for you. If you do call it for a Tuesday that's listed and there is a board meeting, we'll cancel that board meeting for the election. If you choose to have the special election before the November election, there are a few things that you'll have to determine tonight. That is the filing fee. The standard filing fee right now for regular elections is $10 for the office of alderman. You'll also have to determine the filing period. That's a two-week period right now for a normal election. An early voting location, which has typically been town hall. They will have early voting as required at the Board of Elections office in Hillsborough. And if you choose an early voting location, you will have to determine the early voting time period and the hours in which it will run during that time period.
Does early voting add to the cost?
No, that was included in the cost.
So the $18,000 estimate included a certain amount. How much included? How much early voting? One week or?
I can go back and look. I'm not exactly sure the time period for the early voting that was included in that estimate.
I think the email I was looking at, it included the one-stop site, so I think it included the time period at which you could do one-stop voting in Hillsborough. But I don't think it included. I don't think it included Carborough.
I don't know how many people.
Oh, so it includes early voting, but it's the statutory minimum on early voting?
Right. The price that we got, I think, because the breakdown we had, I know for staff it said $11,000, one-stop site and election day. It didn't articulate, an additional site.
I don't know how many people from Carborough are going to drive up to Hillsborough for early voting.
I'm going through my emails right now.
So. I know I will, but...
There will also be absentee voting, just was okay. As allowed with any other election.
Right.
Can I get in front on this? I've talked to a whole lot of people and have vacillated back and forth on how to best handle this. The price of it I find concerning. I find that very concerning. On the other hand, I was certainly part and parcel of the group that made the decision after our last appointment, which was really so contentious that it was it took a while for the community to heal afterwards. It was not a good thing, and out of that came the commitment from this board that voters should decide who's representing them. You know, when we're faced with these things. And so I've gone back and forth between whether or not to support having a special election or to wait until November. And because I was involved with the idea that we should have a special election to fill a seat, I'm going to support having a special election to fill a seat. I would like for us, though, to revisit this afterwards, after we make the decision, and see if we can fine-tune it a little bit. I think it is sloppy around the edges, and there may be some parameters that we could set having to do with the amount of time and whether or not we would call a special election. I feel in some ways that because this is such a short period of time, especially when you look at the amount of time the board doesn't meet, that this person wouldn't take office till the earliest in April. We don't meet for 2 months in the summertime. Then we come back either mid to late August, have a handful of meetings, and then there's the election. I just wonder if that many meetings is worth that amount of money. But I committed to this process years ago when we appointed Dan, and I think that for this go-around, that's what we need to go with. But when we finish with this, I want us to look and see, look at the time parameters when it comes to appointments. So I'm going to support it, and I would like it to be as early as possible, because if we're going to spend the money, we should get our money's worth time-wise.
And what date is early as possible?
March 5th.
Well, maybe a little later than March 5th, because we want to give people enough time to, you know, we want a field of candidates to run. And if you have to have the 2 weeks, you know, filing periods, so maybe later in March.
Lydia?
Well, I did find an email that says the $18,000 does include early voting here at Town Hall. And the filing period, that's 2 weeks now with a regular election. This is a special election that we're determining it tonight. So your filing period, if you wanted a week filing period, that's the Board of Aldermen's call at this point.
No, I think longer.
2 weeks.
Okay, well, let's come back to that in just a second.
Yeah. I wanted to follow up on Jackie's comments. I, too, agree that we should go forward with a special election. I definitely think we need to revisit it after the election's over, revisit the process. But it's what we're bound to now. And really, this is almost the ideal time period you have for a special election, when you have almost a whole year that this person would serve. I mean, if we had someone resign in, you know, May, June, July, August, then we would put off till November, you know. But when someone resigns in on January 5th, or whenever Dan's letter said, it in essence is an entire year without a board member if you wait until the general election. So, you know, I think the timing is as maximum as it could be for what the intent of this special election was. Like Jackie, I'd like to see it happen as quickly as possible with proper notice to everyone. So maybe mid to late March, something like that. Not the earliest date here, but something where the person could be on board by April. Because there's a lot that is going to be done this year, not just on the board, but on all of our committees and everything else. So.
Okay. And I agree with that. I'm starting to think that it may be one of the silliest decisions I ever made, but it is a decision I made. So mm-hmm. I feel like we need to move forward with it. Let's talk about, I'm sorry. You wanted to speak on this item?
Yes. Has anyone considered Skype?
As far as it relates to voting?
Dan,
he no longer lives in Carrboro.
Well, he's actually
he's immigrating.
The question was raised about participating by Skype. Let me say there's a couple problems with that idea, but the number one problem with that idea is that North Carolina law does not allow for that, and that issue has been explored with the legislature in the relatively recent past, and they've declined to acknowledge electronic participation as being participation in the board. Also, he has in fact already resigned, so moved. So that matter is decided. But it's an interesting question you raise, and I think the law is bound to gradually evolve on that particular point, but we're not there now, we have to respect what the legislature has decided for us about that. There Before I go to you real quick, Sammy, let me just point out, so there, it seems to me that there's, I can think of three issues for us to decide here. One is, what is the date of the election? Two is, what is the length of time period that we're going to expect for filing of candidates? And then the third thing is what we're doing exactly about early voting, because the early voting is a significant part of the cost of the thing. Sammy, go ahead.
I'm going to also support this. If this would have been something that had been put in place many years ago, the fact that it is pretty recent and in response to concerns from the community and that there was all that tension around it, I think we should go through and learn from it. But soon after it, we have to revisit and consider whether we want to open the option for appointments or have this as an option, too, on the table. As for when to do it, I think the earlier the better, and we should maybe have the opportunity for when you can, the filing period can be pretty long. I don't know what the requirement is, how late before the actual election, but I'm sure folks would want to file the sooner the better for them to have a campaign. I'm not averse to going, into mid-March either, though, but because it's not really that big a difference.
Let's have a discussion about date of the election, if I may.
Well,
I direct the conversation for a moment.
Okay. Well, can I just say that I'm in agreement, and then
absolutely.
Let's just move on.
Okay.
March 19th.
I'm fine with whichever of these dates. I'll throw out there that I believe that some private business of mine will call upon me to be gone April 9th, which I think is, or whatever that Tuesday is that's around that date. But sounds like people want to do it sooner than that. That's fine.
Do you know when March 19th?
Well, does anybody know when spring break is? I don't want to have it during spring break.
Oh, that's a good
some point. Spring break. I mean, my spring break is
hold
the
on.
First week in
I'll Google
March,
that.
So.
14th is the last day, so the 19th would be.
Are you talking about the universities, right?
I think we need to consider all the spring.
Like, so the 12th. Universities.
First week in April's the public schools.
We should
first
do
week
the
12th, in April's public schools, and the university is when?
It ends. The first day back is March 14th.
Okay.
So
the 19th would work.
How can that be?
How can what be?
Well, the first day back is the 14th.
When's the first day out?
Well, no, but I guess my point is the first day back is a Monday.
So be the 18th.
Well, March.
Does anybody have an
March 14th
calendar?
Can't be a Monday. March 11th. Okay, so March 11th is when they're back. So the 19th would be fully a week after.
A week after.
Oh, 8 days after spring break was
okay.
Over. Okay. So is there a motion, well, no, but just almost in the form of kind of a straw poll here, is there anybody who disagrees with March 19th?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So let's consider that aspect of it settled for the moment. So the filing period then would begin, the filing fee is regularly $10, is that right?
$10.
So presumably the filing fee for this would also be $10.
Right.
We're all in agreement on that.
Right.
Yes. $500. Do we get to keep the filing fee or does no? All right. $10 would be the filing fee. A filing period should be what time? What's the earliest it could be then? If we're going with March 19th?
45 days back from March 19th is the legal notice required. We meet that requirement. So tomorrow I will let Tracy Reams with the Board of Elections know your decision. They can post the legal notice in the next edition of the paper. Right now the filing period is in July for a November election.
Right.
So we're saying January we'll have the 45-day legal notice. The election will be March 19th. 2 weeks in February,
maybe early February, February 1st through the 15th. Those are both Fridays.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And then that gives a month, a little over a month until the election.
And for people, and it also gives almost a month for people to kind of think about it.
And I believe that, well, the way this is usually otherwise done in North Carolina law is from noon until noon.
That's correct.
If I recall. Mm-hmm. So we would go noon February 1st to noon February,
15th.
Friday, February 15th. All right.
Yeah.
And then what are the other blanks on the resolution?
Hours.
Early voting location.
Would it take up this space? I mean, I don't think we'd need that many machines. And if it does take up the space, then the question of having it be as central as possible, such as could even be in the lobby of the Century Center at the entrance of the library.
The issue with early voting is always that they want to have it be in a room where the machines can be locked up at night. No one will have access to that room, so that no one could potentially have access to the machines. So something like the lobby of the Century Center or something doesn't really work very well. I just would question the notion of whether it's important to have early voting, any more early voting than is absolutely the minimum required, and which is for there to be, a week or something of early voting at the Board of Elections in Hillsboro, and just say, you know, the unusual nature of this election is such that and the cost being such an important consideration here, that I don't know that we need to have any early voting other than what the statutory minimum is.
So it would reduce the 18,000 a little bit also.
That's correct.
Yeah, and maybe not even a little bit, but possibly significantly.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't it reduce it from 18 to 10?
We won't put our clerk on the spot on that issue, but I think the point is that it's significant because they have to pay for people to be here
all day long
during open early voting.
And then those people have to do something.
They also have to be here.
What about absentee?
Well, that's required.
That's required.
That's spelled out by the legislature. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they have required absentee voting.
So my suggestion would be regarding additional early voting that there be none.
Okay.
That is, say, there will be early voting, but only what is established under North Carolina law at the Board of Elections in Hillsboro.
I agree.
Our board meeting, if we were, I'm not sure whether we're even supposed to have one on March 19th, but it would be canceled if there is one.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so is there a motion for that resolution as just outlined?
Yeah,
March 19th, $10 filing fee, filing period to be first 2 weeks of February, noon to noon.
And the dates February 1st through 15th,
right?
And that early voting be only what is required.
All right. Is there a second for that motion?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. All right.
And there's also a budget ordinance amendment. As attachment B.
Very good. Is there a motion for the budget ordinance amendment?
I'll move attachment B.
Second.
And do we need to make an adjustment that based on what the early voting, if we go with the minimum required, that's going to be readjusted when you find out how much that is?
So it may not be as much.
It may not be 18.
Well, just because we budget it doesn't mean they have to spend it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Just because it's budgeted doesn't
mean
we'll spend it.
Knowing the instincts of our town manager, I'm confident we won't spend anything more than we have to.
Okay.
So that was moved by
Nate.
Randy. And is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Lydia. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Mr. Mayor, the charter amendment that would authorize you to have the option but not the requirement of having the voting, of having the election, the special election, If you want to consider it this year, the deadline for introduction is like March. So
that's right.
I mean, we'll come to that in item F6 in just a moment.
Right. Okay. I thought you were talking about some time down the road. I just
I hear that, but it's a good point. No, we're going to have to take it up. We're going to have to begin to take it up shortly if that's what we're going to pursue.
Yeah. It's drafted there. It's pretty simple. But.
Okay.
Right. Thank you, Mike.
Very good. I think that completes F3, and that brings us to the GigU North Carolina Next Generation Networks RFP release. Mr. Ranger.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Andy Vogel will present the staff report. We have a PowerPoint for you, and then questions, and also some folks from UNC and others are here, so we'll introduce them as the meeting goes on.
Yeah, I've got three people signed up to speak on this item. Four.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Just to serve as a refresher, the North Carolina Next Generation Network, or NCNGN, pronounced NC Engine, is a regional effort by four leading universities and six municipalities to bring super fast, ultra high speed internet access to our communities to promote educational development and economic development. The regional members include these people listed right here. And I won't read through them, but just you can see it. So the NC Engine Group has been working for the last 6 months to build an RFP. That RFP has now been completed. The RFP reflects a collective effort by this group to produce a RFP that's flexible enough to receive responses for each community that fits their needs and their values. It's a really unique opportunity, if we participate in this RFP, to receive this regional-type response. It could be, who knows what it could offer. It could be very interesting. It could be very next generation. It's something that would be very beneficial possibly to be part of. The RFP's core goals are create gigabit fiber optic network to foster innovation and promote economic development, provide high-speed internet service at a substantial discount, create a framework that maximizes competition and service delivery, leverage public and private assets to reduce the digital divide. And that's a very big one for the town of Carrboro. And that's something that other communities are also very much behind. And the good thing about this RFP is that Carrboro is the one who will be looking over the responses and deciding what gets done in Carrboro. As with other communities, all communities want to be able to control what happens within their borders. Carrboro, if they see the responses, may find something that looks very fitting, or they might want to negotiate with a potential responder to see what they could have done. Or they may elect, after you guys see the responses, may say, hey, this just isn't for us, and you can walk away. There's no obligation. So to participate in the RFP, nothing's lost at all. If there are any town assets offered in the negotiations with a vendor, all pricing will be approved by the Board of Aldermen, by you guys. There's also a steering committee that has been formed to kind of manage the long-term success of this project. It will have a standing representative from each municipality and each university. It will also have two sub-work groups. One is a technical evaluation or advisory group, and the other one is a vendor interfacing or negotiating group. And that's just to provide a common face to the potential responders. Here's the proposed project calendar. And the important date here is this release of the RFP. We are looking at a February 1st release date. And here are some other dates. And these dates are proposed. They may change. And the town has the ability at their discretion, at our discretion, to change any of these dates to move them off. And so what you have in front of you is a resolution authorizing the town manager to participate in the NCNGN request for proposal release and in the evaluation of responses received from vendors. And so that's what we're asking you tonight, is to see if you would be interested in participating in this release. And this is the potential service area. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
I noticed that in the RFP that there was a preference given to vendors offering high-speed network. And so there's two questions related to that. On the one hand, it sounds like this entity will have a preference. So when the question is, we can say who's going to supply or not, it's obviously in agreement with the coalition. And then also reading, if we want to contract independently with an entity, then we'd have to wait for when this process is done, we could do that thereafter.
Correct.
My concern is just the some of the definitions for what we're seeking through this RFP process. When CARBRA's main interest is to guarantee access to the internet, and there may be potentially a significantly higher quality internet provided, that the priority not be necessarily for high speed when you can achieve with this infrastructure, for example, through repeaters, a good quality speed and perhaps even at a much cheaper cost and perhaps even for everyone in CARBRA. So I'm just concerned that this RFP doesn't really reflect that kind of notion. On the other hand, recognizing that we could get a lot of responses that could help inform our thinking towards a more in line with CARBRA values, I do see there being value in going along with this. Another concern is that that we lose sight of where we're starting from and that we get caught up in the excitement of the process and lose sight of what our original values were. So that's kind of what I'm trying to balance when thinking about supporting this RFP, our participation in it or not. You know, there will be submissions to this, to other municipalities that we'll also have access to. So, I don't know, these are some of the questions that I have as we look at this.
Did you want to address any of that, or you don't have to?
Oh, sure. It's interesting. I think the idea behind this is to try to usher in the next generation of applications, the things that haven't been thought of yet. The uses that there are very smart people out there will take advantage of this quicker stuff. The telemedicine aspect or telehealth aspect, pushing large imaging around and stuff very easily to doctors' homes, providing that type of imaging to rural areas from other areas. That might not affect us in this thing, but that's what it's all heading to. And I guess there's kind of the thought that it's hard to say what will be done. It's once it's there, it'll be built to. Just like the people who, when they first created the internet, they never thought, not that Facebook's, whether it's valuable or not, that's, you know, whatever. But these different things that push the economy, that create new jobs and stuff like that, right. Who knows what that will facilitate in the future. So.
And I'm in agreement that it's great to look in advance, and especially when there's something that isn't already here. But the other thing that's not already here is access for everyone. And free access, if that were available, would be a first, too, that also supports the economy and would allow for access to everyone. So my main point is, you know, if the bandwidth is such so high that we could achieve free internet for everyone, and perhaps the cost wouldn't be the high speed of and that would allow for the kinds of technologies that you're describing, we could perhaps achieve those kinds of technologies in high bandwidth areas such as our public library or other venues, and still provide those services to the public for free too. Maybe not in everyone's home. But in everyone's home, you'd have the bare minimum of free utility service, internet.
Absolutely. Yes. And I'll say the group had also talked about that there could be the possibility, you know, in the vendor and looking at the response and stuff like that, to work with them to. There's no silver bullet for the digital divide, but this could be connectivity, and maybe you could work with a vendor to supply computers. Who knows? But that's something that we would, if you wanted us to proceed, knowing the interest in the digital divide, we could work with. We have great people in our community who can help us figure those solutions out, and maybe we could leverage this to get that done. But
okay. I do have a number of members of the public signed up to speak, but is it okay if we...
I'm fine.
Do you want to go ahead, Randy, or do you want to hear from...
I'll wait to hear from the public and then raise my questions.
Okay.
The first person signed up here is Judith Blau.
Thanks, Amy.
I think my role on this board is to bring utopian ideas, and I'm not a computer programmer. I don't know the technology of the advisory committee that I'm serving on, but I do know.
Dr. Blau, speak right into that mic so
microphone.
People at home can get you. Go ahead.
I cannot help but look through the world through a social science lens. After all, I've been a sociologist for 43 years. So I observe what happens in communities when they get broadband. In Abbey Court, when we moved into Abbey Court, it was a very desultory, depressed, alienated community. And we started the Human Rights Center. But then what really made a difference was when we collaborated with Technology Without Borders, who installed, we had the server, and the server provided service for virtually the entire community. And it was Technology Without Borders that put connectors on all the buildings.
You're talking about like a Wi-Fi network.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it made a difference for the children's learning. Their end of grade test scores went up. They became very skillful at using the computers. That was very clear. But it made a huge difference for the community. This was something that they shared. They were part of the larger community of Carrboro. They could watch Mexican soccer teams on streamed in on their computers. And it provided a very socially cohesive. And you know, we also worked with Cramden Institute, and we got 50 free computers from them through the public schools. So this all made a tremendous difference for not only for individuals, the learning of kids, the access of information of adults, but the cohesion and the vibrancy of the community. When we were kicked out of Abbey Court, all of those connectors came down, and they no longer have free Wi-Fi, for which I'm very sorry.
Thanks, Dr. Blau.
I'm, I just retired. So.
You still get to be called Dr. Blau.
Right.
I don't know whether we're still allowed to call you Professor Blau, but we can for sure still call you Dr. Blau. Thank you, Judith. Kristen Smith.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the Aldermen. I just wanted to be here and ask the mayor's forgiveness as I made similar comments last night at Chapel Hill Town Council, but I am here because I know that you value also that recruiting and retaining employers is important to our community and the health of our economy, that this is an opportunity to build an infrastructure that is needed in a digital knowledge-based economy. This infrastructure meets the needs of all types of workers, from the stay-at-home mom website designer to a major employer in the healthcare industry. Telemedicine and the healthcare industry was mentioned earlier. This infrastructure will help us differentiate our area and help us recruit the kind of employers and industry this community desires. And we hope that you'll move forward with this project. Please let me know if I can be of assistance. Thanks.
Thanks, thank Krista. Brian Russell. And then Terry Buckner. Not Terry, but Larry. Okay.
Hi. I just wanted to make sure you knew that I understand where the RFP is not binding and that I support the ideas behind this. Hello, my name is Brian Russell, and I am the founder and chairman of Orange Networking, a local tax-exempt nonprofit in Chapel Hill. Our primary mission is to bridge the digital divide in all of Orange County. I'm here today to ask you to slow down this RFP. Let's be more careful and craft it better. The RFP before you now is not ready and will take us down the wrong path. The most serious reason this RFP should be changed is the town's inability to enforce important parts of contracts that may come from it. In this RFP, on page 3 and 4, goals 4 and 5 cannot be enforced by municipalities. Also, there is serious doubt that the, quote, public interest obligation tied to fiber leasing will be strong enough, especially if this issue ended up in court. As you know, all municipalities over North Carolina have been stripped of any legal authority to franchise or regulate either cable or broadband systems. Let's say this RFP does attract interest and the town entered into an agreement. All kinds of promises could be made to fulfill our interest of controlling cost and providing equal access, but when the time came for this to happen, a business may choose not to honor these agreements. At that time, you would have not the authority to compel that business to bridge the digital divide. Right now, all you can do is lease your fiber and with the money the town has earned, attempt to bridge the digital divide. Telecommunications partners are not going to do this for us. There are ways to rewrite this RFP with the help of Catherine Rice and Cynthia Poles. Ms. Rice is a well-known defender of municipal rights to develop broadband networks, and Ms. Poles is the former general counsel of the National League of Cities and their federal telecommunications lobbyist. Both women have provided pro bono work to the town of Carrboro already for over 3 months. Unfortunately, few of Ms. Rice and Ms. Poles' ideas for how to create a digital divide RFP have been included. Let's slow down and get this RFP right. I'm at your disposal to answer questions and to work further on this. I hope the mayor and aldermen will take the time to guide the improvements of the RFP. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Larry?
Good evening, Mayor and members of the board. My name is Larry Conrad. I'm Vice Chancellor for IT and the Chief Information Officer at UNC Chapel Hill. And hopefully you all recall I was here last spring to introduce the concept of GigU. As you heard from Andy earlier, it's moved along quite well. It's expanded into a regional offering. What we discovered as we compared notes with the other GIG.U university members and their consultations with their respective communities is that there was a high degree of shared interest and shared desires and aspirations. Now, of course, every municipality is going to be a little different. So that's what we have spent these last many months working together with the larger group. We brought in Charles Meeker and Parker Poe, who's led a legal team to work with the legal reps from each of the municipalities. There's been a considerable amount of vetting and discussion that's gone on into the verbiage that's in the RFP. I know Mr. Russell's raised some issues. All I can tell you is we have had those vetted carefully amongst the legal reps for the municipalities and Park Powell, and I guess I would say there's a respectful disagreement over the concerns that have been raised. But at any rate, it's been a truly collaborative effort. There's really no risk to Carrboro or any of the municipalities for proceeding ahead on this thing. The agreeing to let the RFP doesn't commit the town to anything. We've tried to craft the RFP in a way that provides for the specific flexibility for each municipality. So you know, Carbo will be in a position to make its own determination about what's acceptable or not acceptable in any resulting contract. And that can be different from what's in Chapel Hill or Raleigh or Durham or what have you. So, again, I am here to speak in support of this. There's been a lot of work on this. It seems to be a low-risk activity. Certainly there's a lot of excitement if we can bring something in. As I think you all know, the legislature has deemed in its wisdom that municipalities can't enter this business directly themselves, so we have to work with a commercially viable service. So there's that trade-off that has to be, you know, carefully set, where you can offer a set of services that are sufficiently attractive that people who have the means can buy into them, and also provide enough to support the kind of open access or the service to underserved areas of the community. That's a high priority, really, for all the communities. Everybody wants some aspect of that included, and that's going to be a key part of the negotiations that go on, hopefully from the resulting bids and in the contracts that result from this. So, again, I urge your support on this and hope we can move forward.
Sure. I've got a question. Carver is a very small, if we look at the map of who else we're involved with in this project, we're tiny. And so when the question comes as to us being able to accept or modify the terms of agreement, I'm not sure that's accurate, given that my understanding is that we'd be going in on this together, and our ability to negotiate with much larger partners, our voice may not be heard. So, I mean, maybe early in the process might be the way in which I could be proven wrong. In other words, if there are concerns that are legal concerns, if we could reflect those in this RFP and not be rushing to send this out and get responses that may not address many of our concerns, you guys might be agreeable to that. Two comments, if I may.
One is, we believe that kind of flexibility is there. Now, is there any guarantee that anybody's going to get any contract out of this? Of course not. It's a bid process. We hope that we're including enough things that are of interest to potential bidders that one or more of the communities will get something out of this. But at the end of the day, there's not going to be one overarching contract. It's not each municipality is going to negotiate their own deal. So, we believe that there's adequate flexibility built into the thing, so that the set of things that work for Carbrill clearly are going to be different than the set of things that work for Raleigh. I mean, that's just, I think everybody gets that and understands that. And that there's no way that that Raleigh could dictate to the smaller entities. So we think the flexibility is there. And I guess I would also respectfully disagree with the perception that this is being rushed. We spent a lot of time on this. This is not being rushed. We've had a ton of people involved with this thing. And a lot of vetting that has gone on, specifically the legal aspects of it. So again, I personally would say the characterization that this thing is somehow being rushed through and pushed in some way, it just simply isn't true. We've spent a lot of time on this over many, many months.
Okay. Lydia.
Yeah. Mr. Conrad, with respect to the, some of the legal concerns that have been discussed and kind of reasonable minds have differed a little about them, has there been any kind of a thought given the players that are involved with this, all the municipalities and all of these universities, to approaching the legislature with some type of local bill or legislation that could kind of put to rest this possible,
concern.
Legal concern, to have some kind of hammering out, if you will, of what might be the concern here with regard to, to what we're trying to do.
Sure. So I guess the straight answer is no. This is a procurement group, loosely organized. On behalf of the other partners in this thing, would say we haven't seen that's something that's in the purview of this loosely organized group. That if the cities and the towns or other municipalities want to push that, that's really something they have to make those decisions on. Yes.
Are there some other areas where this is currently happening?
Sure. There, over the last several months, there's been an announcement in Chicago. There's been probably the most intriguing one is the announcement in Seattle. They're actually going to deploy something like this to about 100,000 of their citizens as initial rollout. The company that they're dealing with actually has shown very distinct interest in our initiative here. I mean, we've made no bones about it. I mean, this is Research Triangle Park. This has cachet. It gets people's attention. We're trying to cash in on that cachet. And that's one of the reasons we thought going in as a group made a lot of sense. So rather than trying to, you know, chop it up and have six different communities go in, we really are trying to pitch this as, you know, here's your opportunity to get this thing installed in the triangle.
It sounds like those are new initiatives. There's nothing that's been up and running for a while, so you can see.
That's true.
Yeah, poor people actually got access, so that's.
Oh. No, that's absolutely true. And I forgot to mention the Google initiative in Kansas City. There are things that are happening, but no. Can you point to some place that's been doing this for 5 years? No. I mean, this is cutting edge stuff, and again, we're hoping to move the move the bar, as it were. And I think in other settings, there's been discussion about the potential economic benefits. That can come from cities who can find a way to get into this kind of a very significantly higher connectivity level. And again, we're trying to do this in a way that doesn't cause the taxpayers to have to write a check. This is something we, you know, it's all crafted so that the private sector makes investment. It's their dime, it's their nickel, it's their risk.
It's our stuff.
Pardon?
It's our stuff.
It's our stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is an investment by our taxpayers.
Absolutely.
So it's not.
Absolutely. But, you know, what's at stake here, and I think this is something that's important to remember. I mean, there's a very important asset that you all are would be making available through mm-hmm. this if you decide to proceed. But it's also important to remember that it's a fairly small percentage of the total asset. You've got, 96, I think,
Let's expand on that. Let's really articulate it because I think, you know, maybe some of us on this board, certainly some people who are listening to you at home, don't know what asset you're even talking about.
Sure.
So what is that asset?
Okay. In fact, that's one of the great advantages that both Carborough and Chapel Hill have, is that you had the foresight to invest in a significant fiber optic installation around the cities, or both the towns.
Mm-hmm. We just, if I may jump in for a second, so over the course of the last 2 years, I think, or so, we've been installing a new traffic signal control system. The traffic lights that you see around Chapel Hill and Carborough are controlled from Chapel Hill Town Hall by the Chapel Hill Engineering Department. We contract with Chapel Hill to provide that service to our community. And that system, you know, used to be done by simple computers that were at each of the intersections around town, but now are being controlled by a central system at Chapel Hill Town Hall via fiber optic cables mm-hmm. that we were able to have installed basically everywhere that you see a traffic light mm-hmm. in Chapel Hill and Carborough. We only needed like two strands of fiber optic cable in order to do that, but as long as we were going to dig up all these sidewalks and streets to install those cables, instead of just laying two strands, we laid 128. Is that right?
144.
Yeah.
144.
That's
good point.
That's significant.
The point being that we installed far more capacity than we really had a need for just for the traffic control system.
Right.
With the idea in mind that some opportunity like this would come along down the road, that the 142 or whatever it is strands of fiber optic cable that weren't being used for the traffic control system could form a part of
some kind of high-speed internet backbone.
Absolutely. And
okay, I wanted to make that point really, really clearly because it points out how smart we are. but also just to understand what is the resource we're really talking about, because if some private company wanted to come in here and put in high-speed internet of their own, we have no authority at all to say whether they can do that or not. They have the Google Fiber could decide to come here. I don't think they're going to, but they could decide that they're going to come here tomorrow and lay their own fiber separate from that. And the state legislature has said we have no authority at all to regulate that, right, to have any say-so right at all about that, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're really offering up, what's really Carbro's skin in the game, as everybody likes to say at this these days, is those 142 or whatever it is strands of dark fiber that we would be making available to be a part of somebody else's network.
Right, and it's also important that as part of this initiative, it's really six pair, I think, max,
yes,
that's being talked about. So it's not like, well, the rest of the, you know, the 142 are going to be turned over to some other entity. Maximum of six, that leaves plenty of additional capacity. This is not envisioned as an exclusivity arrangement, so it doesn't really, you know, block further considerations or further initiatives at some future point.
And when he says six, he's talking about six pairs of strands, because people like him always talk about pairs of strands.
Oh yeah.
But just so it's clear, so that's 12 total 12 strands out of the 144, or out of the 142 we're not already using.
Right.
Point
yeah
being that
there's 130
we have
left.
That even if we do this deal, there's something like 10 times that capacity still out there that we would still have control over.
Yeah. Tremendous asset, tremendous flexibility, tremendous capabilities.
I don't say all that to lead to necessarily one conclusion one way or the other, but just so we
have a good context.
Have a grip on what we're talking about here.
Related to that question of all that surplus capacity that we do have, is there a restriction, for example, in North Carolina for if a company makes all the investment and then the town has the ability to provide a similar service at a much cheap or free, to provide it for free, would we be liable for aggressive competition or anything like that?
My understanding is that the state law, and we've got some attorneys behind me over here who are far more familiar with this than I am, but my understanding is that we can still provide free service, but I don't know how. I mean, that's what the statute says. It exempts the free service from the prohibitions and limitations otherwise applicable. Now, what the practicalities are of providing free service and how you do that, I don't have the slightest clue.
Okay. So let me suggest I can't remember. We met last night, but this brother back here wants to speak. Come on up. What was your name again?
Kevin Davis.
Kevin Davis.
All right. Thank you.
If you would come
thank
up.
You.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Kevin Davis, and then we're going to go to, are you Cynthia? Catherine Rice. We're going to go to Catherine Rice afterward. Go ahead.
Mr. Mayor, members of the board, I'll keep my comments brief because I think much of the discussion has touched on the items we've talked about or we're going to talk about. Again, my name is Kevin Davis. I'm an IT director in the Central IT Department at Duke University. Our Chief Information Officer, Tracy Futhi, could not be here tonight, so I just wanted to speak to a few words about the regional collaboration and why this is being looked at as a regional RFP. As Larry intimated, we are very unique among the three dozen university communities or universities and their communities nationally that are part of the GIGU initiative in that we are a region. In our case, six municipalities and four institutions. That's very interesting to some of the providers. In some cases, very large cities like Seattle and Chicago have found business. Other small traditional university towns like Old Town and Orono, Maine, and Gainesville, Florida have been selected. But we really have a unique positioning as a region that we think is attractive. This is also a situation where, much like a buyer's club works, there's advantages to going in bulk, and there's advantages to attracting the most competitive interest from bidders if we have multiple communities out there. But the structure, in a sense, is to go out there with one voice and say, as a region, we really want to participate in this. We really want to be engaged and bring in a next-generation network and leverage all of the cachet of RTP, all the cachet of the Research Triangle brand, and the large employers that are here many of whom are not in either Durham County or Orange County, who are very, very attractive to these providers. But then once we have these providers engaged, there's a clear recognition, I think, of the structure of the RFP and the excellent work that many of the staff here in Carrboro and the other towns and some of our university staff have worked on, that towns will make different decisions. And I wanted to emphasize that there's not an expectation that if there were 10 bidders, there would be three finalists and one selected for all six municipalities. And each municipality would then say yes or no to the common choice. If anything, and something that is an experimental network to the point that was made earlier, or something that there's not a long track record on, you know, there's, as in biology, heterogeneity has its advantages. And avoiding a monoculture, as we've all seen the effects of a monoculture in broadband, is not a bad thing. So having competition, both among providers to provide a network like this and even within the region, there's language in the RFP specifically aimed at what's called on-net services. So if we have provider one sitting up in Durham on this network and provider two in Carrboro and provider three in Raleigh, the traffic between all three of those, if I'm living in Carrboro and I have an appointment at NC State but I do work with a fellowship at Duke, there's not bandwidth charges going between those networks, even if different providers build them out. So recognition that we want a really competitive, really strong regional network is one of the key elements we're looking for in the RFP. Again, to try and create that environment where each community can find the right choice for them, and hopefully we have a diversity of responses, both from existing providers as well as new entrants. So that's a very important aspect of this proposal. With that, I think that's all I wanted to add to what I think has been a good conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Catherine Rice, and then we'll Catherine Rice, and then we'll kind of. Oh, and Terry.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me? Because I'm talking through a lot of mucus right now.
You sound fine.
Okay. I just won't breathe too heavy on the microphone then.
That's good.
Yes, I'm Catherine Rice, and I was the broadband consultant to the Triangle J Council of Government Broadband Consortium for a decade. And I'm also the president of SOTOA, which is an association of local government broadband planners and community video producers in four states. So I can tell you, as somebody who was marching the halls of the state legislature over the last 4 or 5 years, trying to get this message across, that it is really wonderful to hear so many people psyched about trying to get gig into our communities. We fell on deaf ears in 2011, and you saw the law that happened. So as Andy would say, our comments are not meant to be a buzzkill. Our comments are because this is such a fantastic project. We want to go into it with our eyes open. And one of the issues that we've seen, and Cynthia Poles used to be the general counsel at the National League of Cities, and I've worked with her for a decade. One of the issues that we've seen is basically, the cold's kicking in, that we are not convinced that you can actually enforce the provisions of the digital divide. There's a difference of opinion, and, you know, I have, above all people, of Mayor Meeker. You know, he was a big advocate when we were trying to oppose that law. But we feel that you need to look really closely at that problem and deal with it. Because the scenario that we're afraid of is everybody's really excited about this. A company comes in, they're really excited about this. And you say, well, we want a gig. And they say, we want to give you a gig. And you say, well, we want to serve the digital have-nots. And they say, we'll do it for you. And everybody sits down and they write a contract out. And the promises are made. And then they build the high-density, high-income areas first. And they've given you a full schedule. They build the high-density, high-income areas first. You notice that the low-income, lower-density areas aren't getting built. You ask about it. They say, don't worry, we're getting there. It's just slowing down. Another year goes by. It isn't built. You ask again. They say, don't worry, we're just about there. Another year goes by. It's still not built. You realize it's not going to be built. You hold the contract up. They say, well, you know what, we've done our homework, and you don't have any enforcement authority on those issues. And so you go to court, and you find out the same thing. We are not trying to kill this gig project. We think that these guys have done an absolutely fantastic job of pulling together a lot of people who care about a gig, because we all want a gig. What we're trying to say is find a way to establish an enforceable contract. We think there are ways. You've got a lot of creative attorneys here. We're willing to put in free time to help you to come up with that. But we're just a little bit worried that everybody in their excitement to make this happen doesn't want to deal with these issues. Let's just ignore it, and if it comes and hits us, then we'll figure it out. So we're not trying to be a buzzkill. We just want you to look at it and figure out a way of actually bringing a solid gig.
So thank you so much for that perspective. It's really valuable to have a diversity of perspectives, too. Are you suggesting that this RFP, when I made the comment that we're rushing this, it was more about the sufficiency of what this RFP represents, less about the fact that a lot of time has been put into it. So to that point, do you think that this RFP could be modified to reflect some of these legal concerns as part of what vendors that make their proposals can address, and so that we will get responses that reflect to the highest degree our concerns?
I would hope so. We have had no time to really think about that. I think that what the folks from UNC are trying to do is keep the process moving, and that's why they've put the February 1st deadline out there. I know these companies are going to do their homework, and they're going to know you don't have enforcement authority. And so I think the more you put that out there in the open and transparently, say we are looking for a company that is willing to work creatively with us, recognizing our restricted legal authority to bring a gig to the communities, both our wealthy and our unserved, I think that's a good thing. Because you're only fooling yourselves to think that they're not going to do their homework. They are going to do their homework. But there must be a way of doing that within a time frame that we can keep the ball rolling. And can that be done in 2 weeks? You know, it sounds like they want to keep it rolling. So,
because I have new life, I went to the Chapel Hill Town Council meeting last night, as several of these other members of the audience did, to participate in this discussion. And just to get down to the kind of the brass tacks of this, I mean, really, because of what I was talking about earlier, the fact that, you know, any broadband company can come in here and tomorrow and do something without us, something that doesn't involve the fiber optic cable that the town installed for the traffic light control system. Really, what we're talking about here is our ability to control, or the terms of control over how those 144 strands of fiber optic that we installed are used. Now, it seems to me, I guarantee that I am the person who least understands all of this from a technological point of view, but it seems to me from a legal point of view that what we're talking about is a lease, essentially. That's what it really gets down to, is the town signing a lease with some company to provide this ultra-high-speed internet service, and the terms under which we would be willing to agree to some kind of lease, or actually not even the terms, but the terms under which we're willing to consider a proposal for a lease, right? I mean, am I mischaracterizing that?
Just slightly. You have dark fiber.
Right.
You can lease it under the law.
Right.
But you can't require anything. You can't require all those wonderful things that are in the RFP.
You can't.
I know Terry's going to want to speak, but you can try to require them, But like I said, they could even agree to be in a contract with you.
Okay.
Okay, but, yeah, so you have the dark fiber. You can legally lease it.
Okay, so this kind of issue comes up all the time when it comes to this general category of issue comes up all the time when it comes to the issuance of land use permits by this board because, you know, inevitably we get into areas where it isn't necessarily 100% crystal clear under North Carolina law whether – the particular condition that we're laying down or that we're asking a developer to agree to is something that is authorized by state law or not. We think it is. Maybe they think it is or maybe they think it isn't. But because they because what they really want is their permit, they go ahead and agree to whatever those terms are, and we go ahead and issue the permit. And because we have a concern about the possibility that they will then try to come back and second guess that in the courts, we'll typically write in, and I know you're an attorney, so you know already what I'm talking about, but we write in what we would call a non-severability clause, a clause that says, well, if you come back and attack certain parts of this permit in court and succeed in getting certain parts of this permit struck down, that the entire permit is void and we need to start over. You need to come back to us for a new permit. And I guess my thought about all of this is, well, why can't whatever lease we might possibly agree to or might consider agreeing to for parts of our fiber optic network have that kind of non-severability clause that would say, well, we require you to do X, Y, and Z as part of this lease. We require you to X, Y, and Z for addressing these digital divide type concerns. But there is a non-severability clause so that if you're going to come back and attempt in the future to attack certain portions of the lease, that the entire lease is void. Do you see what I'm saying?
Could I address it, Mr. Mayor?
Go ahead.
Well, I think the issue that – well, first of all, let me say that it would not be accurate to suggest that these issues have been ignored. They were not ignored. I mean, we acknowledged that there are different viewpoints, and certainly I think Mr. Meeker takes the point of view, as I did at least initially, that we could add these conditions because – not in terms of our franchise, but because they would be conditions in the lease of our facilities. But the other considerations, and I'll get to your issue of the addressing the non-severability clause, that's another reason why I think Mr. Meeker feels strongly that these conditions would be enforceable because you would have a non-severability clause that would say if you attack the clause that you lose your lease. The issue that I think that nobody knows the answer to is whether or not one could nevertheless go to court and make the argument successfully having installed the system, that these conditions that were imposed were contrary to public policy because they are effectively franchise conditions, and the General Assembly has said you can't include franchise conditions. And I think your analogy to the zoning conditions, which we often put, not often, routinely are universally put in there, is appropriate because the answer is, would that be sustained if we oppose a condition and they seek to throw it out? We had a case like that, and eventually we won that case. But, I mean, nobody knows whether that kind of condition is going to be enforceable. We've had some experience with in an unfortunate case over in Cary where there was a rezoning subject to conditions. They built the development subject to the conditions, went back and attacked the conditions, and we argued strongly that you can't have one without the other. You know, you got the development. You shouldn't be able to avoid the conditions, and the court ignored it and voided the conditions and let them go forward with the development. So I think that the short answer is let me add one other qualification. In terms of the theory that, which I subscribe to, that you can impose lease conditions, there are some of the attorneys, particularly the attorney from Raleigh, feels like that is a good answer with respect to the facilities which we would lease. That is to say, if you're going to lease our facilities, the dark cable that we already have, the extra 144 strands or whatever it is, if we're going to lease those, that which you are leasing, you can impose these sorts of conditions on that. But the issue for him, and I think it's a valid issue, is can you impose the same conditions on the facilities which they build and that you didn't own, which is another issue. The bottom line of all of this, I'm saying.
I mean, and, you know, common sense says probably not, because, I mean, that's exactly what the legislature is trying to prevent us from
well,
doing.
Well, if that's the case, then obviously the only conditions that, that you really wouldn't be able to impose upon them the condition that as you build the remainder of the system, you'd have to have universal build-out. The bottom line on the thing is simply this. There isn't anyone who can tell you with a surety whether or not these conditions, whether the scenario that Ms. Rice has laid out, which is one that we contemplated, and I've said exactly the same thing, that would be the scenario that would occur. They would agree to the contract, get the system half built out, and then go back and seek to validate the conditions. Would they be successful at that? You know, I would argue strenuously that, you know, it's a lease condition. They accepted it. You know, the arguments about estoppel, I could cite all kinds of case law, and they would cite all kinds of case law. And anybody who would tell you they know how that comes out is not being candid with you. And there's no way to overcome that. I don't think there's any way to construct either a proposal or ultimately an agreement that's going to answer that in an ironclad fashion. So the question is, if you're in terms of going forward with it, are you willing to consider or entertain the possibility, looking at the advantages of the system, against the worst case scenario is that just exactly what was contemplated.
Yeah.
The contract is let. They're building the system. You get a lot of economic advantages. A lot of people are served. There's an economic job growth, blah, blah, blah. But they invalidate the conditions for the full service and the conditions about subsidization of neighborhood. That's the worst case. Do we think that case is likely? The opinion's very, I think Ms. Rice probably comes out on the side of that's highly likely. I'm not nearly so much on that side. I'd be prepared to mount a spirited defense of it, but I'm not going to tell you we'd be successful. So I think you'd have to say if you're willing to accept the possibility that that could occur and accept the possibility of the worst-case scenario looking at all the benefits, then you go forward with a proposal in terms of getting the RFP. If your conclusion is that under no circumstances would I entertain even the possibility of agreeing to such a system, if the possibility exists of that worst-case scenario, then I would say there's no reason to go forward with a proposal. I mean,
well, and let's be honest. I mean, if you're going to say, well, we're not going to do whatever it is because of the possibility that North Carolina law, unclear parts of North Carolina law could be resolved against us, then, you know,
then we never do
then
anything.
You're never going to do anything. Because let me tell you what,
there is
that possibility is always very real. And I'm not just kidding or whatever, but I mean, the legislature has demonstrated their willingness to do things that are, you know, from my point of view, very clearly contrary to the public interest when it comes to this kind of thing. Jack,
as one of the few people in the room who's not a lawyer,
I'm not either. Welcome. By the way.
Okay, I if we go ahead with the RFP, when we go to and then we decide that we want to go into a contractual relationship with a vendor,
mm-hmm.
How bound are we to what's laid out in the RFP in constructing that contract?
I don't think as was indicated, I think there can be individual contracts, but it's also conceivable that first of all, I don't know if anybody's going to respond to the proposal, but I mean, if you do get vendors who are interested in doing this, it may range from someone might come in and say, the only way I'm interested in doing this is if I get it all, I'm going to build it all out, and I'm going to build it all out pursuant to uniform conditions of approval of where the lines are going, whether it's going to be sort of uniformity or I'm not going to do it, in which case you could say yes or no to that. I mean, but I think the short answer to your question is we have the ability to – they've got to sign a contract with us, but, I mean, the vendor may say, I'm not going to sign a – I'm not going to go through all this unless I get sort of uniform conditions from everybody. Or the vendors might say, no, I'm willing to do, agree with Raleigh. Raleigh isn't imposing a universal requirement or requiring any subsidies of the cost for particular neighborhoods. Carborough wants to do that. That's fine. I'll agree with that with Raleigh, and I'll agree with that, with you. So I think, you don't know until you get the response from the RFP what they're going to request. It's an agreement. So, I mean, if they propose, it's got to be all or nothing, and you could say, well, it's nothing. Or you could say, No, I mean, you can negotiate, but they don't come in here and, let me back up. They can't get access to our facilities unless you to the lines that we've already built, unless you agree. I certainly agree with what the mayor said, and we've discussed it among the attorneys. You know, somebody could come in here tomorrow and do everything that's in the proposal for an RFP and not get our consent if they weren't going to.
If they're not using our fiber,
they don't need us. That's right. Exactly right.
I have a question. I want to be clear. So the lease condition language, does it make more sense to have stronger, more creative language crafted at the RFP point, or is that something that we can set more firm conditions, or at least get it out there and for the transparency? Because I think that's a very important point about the transparency.
No, I don't think you try and negotiate the all the words of the document. I think the RFP clearly states at the outset on page 3 or 4 the intention that there be build out requirements and some sort of how do they phrase it? Subsidization of rates for certain neighborhoods. I don't have the language in front of me here.
Right, right.
But I think the intention to have those provisions included is clearly stated in there. So I suppose, I mean, again, the alternatives are if I'm a vendor generally interested in the concept, I could say, I mean, they may respond and say, well, one thing they may do is to say, well, I look at those conditions and say, there's no way I'm going to agree to that. I'm not going to respond. Number two, I'm responding and I will agree to do it. Or number three, I'm responding, I'm real interested in the system, but I can't agree to those conditions. I mean, those are the three old possibilities you could get.
All right, I don't want to take us too far afield, but just for a moment, we have a number of other items on our agenda. I have a couple more people signed up to speak on this, and the board has not even finished its discussion of these issues. I'm wondering, Mr. Manager, how would you feel about rescheduling the capital improvements program update to a meeting later this month or sometime early in February? Is that?
I believe we can postpone because we don't kick off our budget process internally until the end of January anyway. As long as if you've looked at this before we kick that off, I think that'll work.
You get a better discussion that way.
I think you would have a more meaningful discussion. George, you're not going to retire in the next 2 weeks, right?
No.
I'm sorry for the staff members who have been staying to speak on this agenda item, but I think if it's okay with the rest of the board that we'll anticipate rescheduling item F5 to a later night. We're still probably going to need to get to F6 and 7 tonight. But, okay, back to GIGU. So... I have a couple more people who want to speak.
I just wanted to note two other things. One is the idea that there is a way to have an enforceable contract that maybe goes beyond just tying all this to the lease agreement, which is this idea of a nonprofit. I don't know if you've seen that, but
I have not.
Okay. Maybe that can be shared with you later because there's a. If you could establish a nonprofit using some really refined legal techniques so that you avoid breaching any of the laws, you can actually have those terms be enforceable in a contract. The city can't do it, but a nonprofit can.
Yeah, that's something that has not been discussed among the attorneys as far as I'm aware.
Okay. Well, that's a point that's worthy of consideration.
And that gets to that point of, you know, do we want to think that kind of thing through and include it so that we do get the kinds of responses we want reflected, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is whether there's any reason that the whoever this internet service provider is going to care about that end of it, you know?
That's more on your end. Their end, it's being creative to work with you on that. The other thing is, don't be surprised if the company comes back and says, what do you mean, 6 fiber? We want all 144, you know, and then maybe we can start talking. So, thank you.
That's a point that's well worth considering.
Thank okay. you so much,
Terry Buckner, and then I've already misplaced your business card. I'm sorry. Tell me your name again.
Van Springer.
Van Springer.
Hello, my name is Terry Buckner, and I've been working on this project since May, although it feels like I've been working on it for many years since I was one of the committee members that actually asked for the fiber to be installed. So my job up here is to throw away what I had planned to say and address a couple of issues. Number one, on the nonprofit, that was an issue that was discussed with the managers early on, and the managers were not interested in it. I think there's several of us on the project who still feel like that is the way that the long-term project should be handled, but for the short term, the managers wanted to handle that through a more informal structure. I wanted to go back to the issue that Catherine raised about, and it's all about legal, and that's all the discussion has been, but there's also some economic issues. What we are trying to do is introduce competition. For the past, 20 years, we have been at the mercy of the large telecoms. We've had to take what they've given us. And what we're trying to do here is say, this is what we want, and this is what we want you to give us. And when we get that, if we get it, we have competition here. And if they decide to change the terms and do something illegal, all we have to do is pull out our service because we have other options. And once we open this door to at least one other company, we don't know how many more will come in, but it becomes more viable then to have true competition in the marketplace. Let's see. I can't read my notes here. Again, I do want to remind you that this is an RFP. This is just a request for proposals. When I worked with facilities, we did these all the times. We went in and we said, this is what we want. This is kind of our wish list, our dream of what would be good for us. And if somebody can meet that dream or part way through, then we figure out how to make it a legal issue. But I don't want you to lose sight of that potential out there. The other issue that has been raised is that we could postpone this. And we had a meeting in November with all of the managers, and the managers agreed to February 1 as the release date. And we agreed at that meeting that any city who was not ready to go on February 1 could come in at a later date, but we wouldn't know when that date would be. But at this point, we've got Durham, Chapel Hill, and Raleigh who have all agreed to the RFP as it stands with the February 1 release date. So that's where we are on that. And finally, just briefly about the digital divide. I think it's really important to realize that this isn't going to solve the digital divide. So, you know, the digital divide consists of both hardware, like what the mayor and Brian have been doing for buying laptops for Abbey Court kids. It's connectivity, which this project brings to it. And it's also about training and outreach. I'm working with a group that Andy's on it, John Berman from Chapel Hill. We've got the university librarians who do training at your library and at the Chapel Hill Library. Judith Blau and her group are part of it. The Chapel Hill schools are part of it. And what we're doing is looking at all of the different groups that are serving, what is everybody doing, and trying to bring it together under a single umbrella so that when somebody needs something, they've got a one-point entry, and they get the same story. And if somebody comes in and says, I want to do this, they get the story of how do you get hardware, how do you get training, where do you go. And our goal in that is to bring the people who are, you know, these people who are the digital divide into the conversation so that when we're ready to negotiate the contract, we're saying what they want, not what we want them to want or what we think they need, but what they think they want and what they think they need. And to some extent, that includes wireless technology, not just wired. And so we have to be flexible with that, and that's part of getting ready for the contract negotiations. So I think Yeah. So I just really want you to remember this is potential, and we always have the chance to say it's not living up to our potential, and we don't want to sign a contract. Thank you.
Sorry, I have a quick question. You were talking about you said that the managers in discussing this idea of the nonprofit that long term they might. Mm-hmm. Were they thinking of that long-term as a possible reaction to a legal challenge, or were they thinking that as long-term in reaction to whatever proposals come down and how it might best work? Or
I don't want to speak for David, but I think my impression is that this is kind of an amorphous idea. You know, everybody's trying to get their head around it, and what's it mean? You know, Catherine has her ideas about the legal. Our group of attorneys has a different idea. We're kind of making this, and I think my impression was that nobody wanted to sign on to a hard commitment until it had a little bit more structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the opportunity to clarify, because I think it's important to put it into context. I'm trying to remember, you know, back, this has been, what, 6 or 9 months, that, you know, about the idea of a nonprofit. What I do think that in the beginning what the managers did say is that we would not be comfortable in turning over the assets to a single entity such as an authority or a nonprofit that we thought that because of the difference in values and the differentiations between, say, one city or another, that we felt like that it was very important to maintain local control. And, of course, that kind of conversation happened prior to this issue that's brought up by Catherine Rice. Certainly, if it takes a local nonprofit to bridge the digital divide, that's something that we are very much open to doing because, as we know from the beginning, so I think it's all within the context and when and how and who all would participate in it.
Can I say one other thing? So what's happening in Kansas City right now? So Kansas City got the Google contract that you all applied for, and their mayors have created an innovation team, and out of that innovation team, a lot's happening. There's been a nonprofit forum to deal with the digital divide issue. There's economic development, so they're doing contests for getting applications developed that benefits the city and the residents. So I think it's all it didn't start out that way with the plan. It's what's evolved with the opportunity. And so if you haven't read about Kansas City, I would encourage you to do so. Google has gone in and made all kinds of accommodations for the low-income residents and the low-income neighborhoods. They've done a really nice job.
Thanks, Terry.
All right. Thank you, Terry. Mr. Springer.
Good evening. My name is Matt Springer, and I'm a longtime resident of Carrboro and the owner of Mad Rock Advisors, a small business consulting firm located right here in Carrboro. I must inform you, full disclosure, I'm a recovering attorney, and I spent over 20 years in telecommunications as general counsel of two different telecommunication companies, including one right here in Mebane, North Carolina. The project that we've been talking about for the last hour provides a rare opportunity for a community of our size to obtain super-fast data speeds at incredibly low prices. By partnering with 5 other municipalities and 4 major universities, Carrboro will be able to aggregate significant business and residential demand, which will attract the limited amount of capital that exists right now in the marketplace from quality telecom and cable TV service providers. It is very expensive to build networks such as these, and to get a head start and an aggregation of demand is what's going to bring the biggest and best service providers offering the best deals to towns like ours. And that's what we are. We're at the front end of an opportunity here. And we can put things on hold. There's certain benefits to that, but one thing that's almost an assurity is that if you wait much longer, the capital will dry up, and the first 10, 12 projects will get off the ground, and for the next couple of years, the service providers will be nursing those opportunities and learning from them. What we have here is for small home businesses such as my own to have access to file sharing and video conferencing at speeds and prices which are not currently available in the market. For example, I currently pay $50 a month for 6 megabits of speed in my house. And under the Google Kansas City model, which recently rolled out, I'd be able to get 100 megabits of speed for $30 a month or a gig for $70 a month. And even at the low end tier, 100 megs for $30 a month, that's 15 times faster at 60% of the price. For doctors in our communities who work at UNC Hospital, they'll be able to get MRIs in 30 seconds, whereas right now it takes them 12 to 15 minutes to download one at home. So for companies like Blue Cross Blue Shields that want to have their workers being able to work out of their homes, this will make it imminently more feasible in a much quicker time frame. So I know it's late, and you guys have put a lot of time into this, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
It's really nice to hear a pragmatic application. So thanks for waiting and speaking to us.
Thank you for speaking for the small home business in Carborough, too.
And I was going to say, I could be wrong, but I think the only Carborough resident to speak on the subject. But, no offense to the rest of you. I want to point out I suspect that some of the other entities who've been participating in this this process up to this point think that, you know, we're just being a bunch of pointy-eared Carborough liberals in harping on this point about the digital divide aspects of the situation. And, you know, you're welcome to that analysis if that's what you feel like you need to come up with. But from my perspective, you know, that with regard to any of this, those people who up to now have been really successful in business and information technology, I have every confidence will continue to be really successful in business and information technology. But I think what's interesting about this, and I don't really mean this as a criticism or a point of disagreement with, for example, what Kristen Smith from the chamber was saying earlier, but what's interesting about this is not what's most interesting about it is not as she kind of emphasized the kind of recruitment and retention possibilities that a next generation network provides, although I think that's important. But what's most interesting about all of this is the next generation of businesses, and you know, the record that that the internet has thus far, and the computer technology in general has thus far, frankly, is that you know, the next great wave of innovation does not have to come from a bunch of people who are already zillionaires. Mm-hmm. That the next great wave of innovation can very easily come from people who simply have a great idea, but it has to be a great idea that is combined with access to the technology. Mm-hmm. And that this is really what it's about. It's not even about that justice somehow demands that kids at Abbey Court should have the same kind of access to Facebook that my kids do, but rather that any of us who have a great idea for a business or for an innovation through technology have, you know, at least a reasonable degree of access to the technology out there to implement that. And, you know, none of this, no matter whether we succeed, and I think what a lot of this board's values are or not, none of it guarantees certainly that anybody growing up in a low-income neighborhood in our community will ever become some kind of tremendous success through the development of online businesses. But we just want to make sure that, and I think this is what I truly view as a fundamentally American value, that that opportunity is there. On the one hand, I very much agree with the concerns that Brian and that Catherine were bringing forward about how the telecom industry's track record is one of a continual subversion of our efforts and subversion of our power and our control as a public entity, but then on the other hand that as I think our town attorney alluded to, all of this is ultimately a certain amount of guesswork involved. We don't know where how our state government will come down. We don't know how our state courts will interpret the laws, and that there's, you know, the best that we could hope for is an educated guess. And what I've heard is that there's a bunch of educated guesses and that they're conflicting about what may be possible. So I guess I'm willing to personally, I'm kind of willing to move forward with this RFP process, but that, you know, I'm confident based on what I've heard that this board is very much going to have this issue at the center of the discussion when it comes to looking at any responses we hear from those who would like to build out the NC engine, as it's being called. And I hope that those who are involved in moving this process forward, not just from Carborough Town staff, but all of y'all who are involved in moving this process forward, are very much going to take to heart what we're saying. You know, it hasn't always been, in fact, if anything, the track record of the internet has been, it's not about your Harvard MBAs. It's about your Harvard dropouts with a great idea. That's and we need to be reaching all of our neighborhoods. The one thing that gives me some real optimism about this is, although Alderman Slade pointed out that our community is small, it's also the highest density community in North Carolina.
So we're dense.
And we are dense.
We're dense.
But we're also bright. no, but the point being that you know, when it that population right. density is a great thing when it comes to network Work. Building. Work. And so in on the one hand, we may be a small player. On the other hand, we're a great place to go first. And we have already built the backbone, and we've built that backbone everywhere there's a traffic light in our community. Mm-hmm. And that also happens to mean that we've built that backbone almost everywhere that there's an apartment complex, almost mm-hmm. everywhere that the highest population density exists. So there's been a lot of pessimism, but I think there's also some room for some optimism about the level of priority that our community may get, even within the NCNGN. Effort, I think we're just going to have to be extremely diligent in looking out for our low income communities. And I don't think it's going to mean that we're going to get free internet for people at Abbey Court. But if it means that we are getting that we are ensuring that $30 a month kind of service is available to people in Abbey Court, and that it's not available to them last, but in fact is available to them among the first, that's the kind of goal that we can shoot for and that's realistic.
Okay.
Everyone?
I don't think there's anybody in our community who is honestly more committed to closing the divide than you are, and you don't just talk the talk. You do a lot of things that people aren't even aware of. So based on your argument not to let the perfect stand in the way of the good, I'd like to move that we move forward with the RFP.
I still haven't gotten clarity on the point And this isn't to hold the process up, but rather even to speed it up. Because what I'm afraid of is that we're not up front with some of these vendors who will be making proposals from outside the state who may not know the intricacies of the law. So I would like to hear if it's possible, just like we attached their attachments about like what Carbro represents and what the infrastructure is, that there be an attachment that just describe kind of the complexity of the legal situation for those vendors so that we do get responses that are as upfront and addressing those concerns early on as possible. And I don't know who would be able to, like, I guess you guys have been in negotiation. Is that something that would be hard to do? Obviously, it wouldn't be in full detail or be divining the future, but it could open raise the question for these people who are going to make the proposals to be aware about something that they have to address.
My own view is it sufficient that we have alerted them to the goal and the requirement that they're going to have to meet. How we enforce that requirement, whether it's through further discussion with this nonprofit or something, which I haven't heard of anything about. I mean, that's news to me tonight. But the mechanism for doing that and the legal language, you know, that or techniques that we would seek to use to maximize our likelihood of being able to enforce that are something we can work on. It seems to me, you know, I certainly concur with what Catherine said, that the folks who would be responding to this RFP are going to understand what their perspective of their legal rights and obligations are in terms of what we can require and what we can't require. But so, I mean, if they're going to, as I said before, if they're going to respond to say, yeah, we'll do this, then it's kind of up to us to devise the best mechanism or the mechanism that we think is most likely to ensure that commitment would be made.
My point is more about, you know, prompting them to present themselves with the highest competitive edge as they can present a case that responds to the complexities of the law in North Carolina. So in other words, including, just as brief as it may be, an attachment just describing even some of the emails we've been getting on the complexities. You know, I'm not wedded to this. I'm just saying this might speed the process because I can see the RFPs coming in and a lot more questions being had because these responses don't really address many of these concerns. So it's just really to speed this process up that I'm saying this.
I guess, so I ask you, should the proposal be, or the RFP be modified to ask the respondents to suggest ways in which these commitments would be made enforceable?
Sure, with an attachment just describing some of the
comments. I certainly don't have any problem, I mean, doing that. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to in terms of conditions. Because it helps filter. It helps filter, you know, the respondents.
I mean, we could, as far as I'm concerned, responding to your question, I mean, I would have no problem with the concept of asking, modifying this RFP proposal to include a request that they, as part of their submission, address, less than page 3 and 4, the goals. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if we wanted to ask them to include in their proposal how they would techniques or requirements they would envision would be the best way to ensure the enforceability of these things. I'm not trying to make up the language here. I mean, I suppose we could ask them to do that. I mean, normally you would just tell them what you're seeking to require them to do, and then we would propose the language. But if you want to ask them to propose the language or the techniques, I mean, we can certainly do that.
I think we should ask them if they decide not to. Well, that, you know, maybe everyone will decide not to, and that's just to their disadvantage.
As far as I'm concerned, we can craft that language and submit it to. But we have to recognize there is only going to be one RFP that's going out. I mean,
Terry. I'm going to give Terry Buckner the last word from the public.
Because the RFP has been already approved, and we don't really want to change it again. How about if we agree to add
Sure.
I think that's a reasonable suggestion.
Do we need to put that? Is that like?
I don't know that.
Do we want to amend?
I think she's this lead staff person on this. So I mean, I think you just heard she hears what you're saying.
Okay.
Right. The other point that's very related to this is you know, this is part of the issue with the process. Like if we're even looking at this today, I would hope that there's an assumption that we could have a response to it and that there could be a reflection of a response in that RFP, and it apparently isn't the case because it's already been approved. So I'm just very much questioning, you know, what we're doing here tonight. I mean, it's a yes or no vote on something without any further input by us.
Well,
No, that's not true because
before anything binding on Town of Carrboro happens, it will come back to us. So I mean,
right. I mean it is an RFP.
I hear your point, but I also think there's another opportunity. We get another bite at this apple, and it's not
right.
And it's
right.
Actually the primary bite.
Right.
This is not even the primary bite. So Lydia, do you have
I was going to second Jackie's motion.
Okay.
I was just going to say I really appreciate Terry's suggestion and Sammy, you know, clarifying further that point.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded for the RFP. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously with caution. That brings us to item F6 on our agenda. I'm wondering whether it would be better to discuss this item on another night. I know that the bill drafting deadline you said is when, Mr. Attorney? Sometime in early March?
Early March.
We will need to make a decision tonight on appointing a delegate for the North Carolina League Advocacy Goals Conference, which is January 24th. We need to let them know tomorrow who our voting delegate will be and also the alternative. The staff memo notes that David Andrews, town manager, will be in attendance. He can be designated as a delegate. Of course, it's up to the board if you are available, if your schedules are available.
Let's move. I move David be the
delegate. Yeah. Second, David.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that we appoint David to be our representative at that meeting. All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
And it looks like we'd have to almost have this discussion next Tuesday, though, because then our breakfast is the following Monday. So.
Okay. Let me just point out that I think it's fine to move it to next Tuesday, probably. Let me point out that we often get very creative about this matter, and that the political situation in Raleigh is such that creativity is not warranted right now.
Or appreciated.
So let's come to this item next week, but let's bear in mind the times in which we live. Item F7, Board of Aldermen Committee Assignments, Dan Coleman's vacant seats. Those vacancies include the Economic Sustainability Commission, which let me point out that we had for years only had one liaison to that committee. We made it two, I think, because there were two people who were particularly interested. So.
And
we were developing the local living economy task force. So I think it's fine if somebody is gung-ho, but I also think it's fine to simply drop back to having one delegate to that. Is there
I have a comment about transit partners after you get through this.
Okay, so is there a motion that we drop back to having one delegate for economic sustainability? That's
yeah,
Randy.
That's
she's already
it.
Appointed.
Yeah, I'm
been
on it.
Moved and seconded by Lydia. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Okay, transit partners.
I was just going to say, I mean, we do need two appointees for that group. Every other entity there has a couple of aldermen, or has a couple of council members of aldermen. But I can be there definitely this spring. Like last fall, my class schedule was such that I couldn't be there. I can be there this spring. we could wait and see what happens with whoever's elected, or Mark, maybe you could be the fallback if I can't be there, or whatever.
Those meetings are very staff intensive, and they happen during the day.
Yeah,
so
they're like at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday.
May I suggest that Lydia cover for now, and then we take this up again on for that particular appointment after a seat is filled, after the election?
Go ahead.
I've got an interest in temporarily being on that, and it's temporarily and not long term, in part because it is during the day and I'm busy during the day. But what my interest is, and maybe you can clarify to what degree this is being taken on, but the electric buses, there was a presentation recently, and I'd just like to see that addressed or pursued, and being on that committee, because I know they had a meeting or presentation on it like a week ago, would be of interest for me.
I'll get an update on that from you.
Okay, well, why don't...
I haven't seen that presentation.
I'll take that as a motion from Sammy that he be appointed, let's say, from now through the end of March.
Sure.
And is there a second for that? Okay.
Sounds good.
It's been moved and seconded that Sammy be appointed from now until the end of March. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. And then the final appointment issue is Home Program Review Committee. This one is important. The Home Program Review Committee makes recommendations to our local governments about how to spend several hundred thousand dollars of federal home program money. And the prime time for the Home Program Committee is actually starting right about now and running for the next couple of months.
But they meet during the workday.
They meet during the workday, and they decide on funding, in part, the organization I work for.
Right.
So I certainly can't be me.
And it makes decisions for one that I'm on their board, so it can't be me.
I'll be happy to read meetings during the day.
Can we appoint somebody who is not a member of our board to serve on that?
We could appoint our staff person.
Yeah, staff person.
Let's do the same thing we did with Transit Partners Committee and appoint from now, let's say through the end of April, because I think the time period is slightly longer. Is there a motion to appoint Annette?
I'll move to appoint Annette through April.
Okay, through the end of April. It's been moved and seconded in several places. That we appoint Annette to serve on that committee from now through the end of April. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right, is there a motion to adjourn?
Mr. Mayor, I apologize. David brought to my attention there is one other group that I didn't have listed on here. It's the Affordable Housing Task Force.
I have an interest in, because that's the subcommittee, right?
That's the subcommittee.
Yeah, I'd be interested in, because that meets in the evening.
Okay, there's a motion from Lydia that she be appointed.
Unless anyone else, I'm just interested in that.
Seconded that Lydia be appointed to that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passing unanimously. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All those in favor signify.